Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! I gotta tell you, this is one of those nights I kind of wish I was doing 6 or 7 hours, because I think I got 6 or 7 hours worth of material. This is Head On for a Friday night. Of course, I'm Bob Kincaid. You are wonderful, you. All of you. So glad that you share your time with us, whether it be live, podcasts, or in the various and sundry means of receiving internet radio that we are connected with, whether it be Receiva, Phonostar, iTunes Radio, or the new listing that we have, whose name has escaped my mind. Sorry about that. I'm sure I'll be reminded in only a matter of moments. Now, there are a million different places to go this evening, but the first place we are going to go is immediately to the phones. For the past 2 weeks, I have been remiss in our Friday conversations with Carolyn Kay of Make Them Accountable, makethemaccountable.com. And that was mainly because I didn't want to run the risk of anybody catching this flu, even through the internet. It was just icky. So we will go immediately to the phones and welcome, for our usual Friday night conversation, Carolyn Kay. Caro, I'm so glad we could get back together again.
Yes, me too. But I'm glad you didn't give me the flu. I mean, I'm really, really glad.
You know what? Of all the things, it's the one thing in the world you don't want right now.
Listen, I know.
This is a nasty one, Caro. I'm not kidding.
Well, the first few years I was in Chicago, because, I mean, I came from Louisiana, which is like another universe, you know. The first few years I was here, I got some really bad flu several times, you know, like once a year for the first 3 years or so. And it was like, it was stay in bed type flu, you know. It was, could not lift your head off the pillows.
Oh, yeah, this is one of those bugs this year, I've had it. My wife's had it. Our dear friend Peter Godbold down in Florida has had it. It's the kind of thing where you get up to walk to the bathroom or something, and it feels like every bone in your body's breaking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've been there.
And, you know, the flop sweats and the upper respiratory. Oh, geez. It's just a misery.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm glad you feel better.
Oh, I believe you me. Thank you very kindly. I am, too. Because I'm a real big baby when I'm sick.
I am, too.
I hurt. I need a popsicle. Yeah, I turned 4 years old just like that when I get sick. But all things being equal, I am back up to speed, and I'm glad to know that nothing has bitten you thus far in the flu season. I hope it
thus
continues
far.
Not to. I couldn't help noticing a news story today, Caro. George Bush has drawn another line in the sand, and I can't help but wonder if Congress is going to take the bait, or maybe in their newfound spinefulness.
Maybe now that his approval rating has dropped down to 18%, now equivalent with Congress, now they'll say, "Oh, well, he's not liked any better than us, so maybe we should stand up to the guy or something."
You know, I think it's time to print T-shirts, Caro. Maybe that says, "George Bush, worse than Nixon. You never thought it could happen, did you?" He has a lower approval rating than Richard M. Nixon, and yet he remains in the White House.
And not only that, he remains defiant.
And that's what I meant about this line in the sand. He has said that there will be no compromise over telecom immunity. So, you know, with this newfound spine that the Congress has, I'm wondering if maybe, you know, because America's not at risk, Caro.
That's correct.
At all.
That's correct.
So maybe Congress now looks at it and says, oh, okay, well, you don't want one that's got that doesn't have telecom immunity in it, then you don't get one at all.
Well, they certainly could say that because the worst thing that could happen is that the law would revert to what it was before the, you know, this previous telecom bill, the one that they were going to update, or rather FISA bill, that updated a previous law. The previous law would remain in effect, which is just, which really is to me everything they needed. But of course, you know, Republicans are never satisfied. There's never enough peeking into other people's mailboxes and stuff for them. So they had to improve upon the previous law, which still is in effect. So that yes, they can find out if they think somebody is a terrorist. The previous law said that they had 3 days. They could say, oh, it's an emergency, get in there. Okay, listen to what they're saying. And they have 3 days to then go to a judge, and one of these secret judges, you know, to say, oh, judge, and of which, if for years and years and years, all the requests that have ever been made, only three were ever denied. Okay, so.
Until the Bush administration.
Well, no, I mean, they were never denied, but that was not enough for them. It was always more, 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 more. Give me more, give me more, give me more power, more power, more, more, more. Excuse me.
That better not be the flu.
No, it's not flu. My throat dried up from saying more, 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 more. I mean, I don't know why it doesn't happen to them. There's never enough for them.
No, there isn't. And the thing that's so frustrating, you know, I'm scared to death we're going to revert to type, as the saying goes. That insofar as, you know, when George Bush vetoed the funding bills for the occupation, we could have said, okay, you had your chance, no more funding bills to, you know, because we got other business to attend to.
Uh-huh.
But they knuckled. They caved.
They have knuckled every single time he has stood up to them and said, I want what I want, and I want it now, and give it to me, or I'm vetoing this bill. And every single time they have caved into him. Except this time. Now, the Senate gave him what he wanted. The House, I'm not sure exactly how it came about, but the bill was supposed to the previous law was effective through last Friday, I think. And of course, Bush was just about to get on Air Force One to go make his triumphal tour of Africa and promise them all this kind of stuff, which means that he's cutting their funding. That's always what happens when he goes somewhere and says, I'm going to, you know, give you more and give you more. Then he comes back and decreases their funding. but he had to get on that plane, see. So I don't know if Congress thought that they were playing brinksmanship with him or what, but they just said, no, we're not doing this. And so he had to get on that plane without anything to sign. So there we are. But again.
But if there was so much threat, shouldn't he have? I mean, if the threat was what he said it was,
I know.
Shouldn't he have stayed home?
So
should I mean?
Dangerous. Yeah. We're all going to get killed in our beds. They're going to chop our heads off and all kind of and videotape it while they do it. And
yeah, sleeper cells are just going to wake up all over the country and
they're going to wake up these sleeper cells.
Yeah.
And they're all going to chatter on the phone, and we won't be able to listen because. Oh.
But of course, there's so much silliness in that, Caro, because, you know, even if we were listening, we couldn't understand because they don't conveniently speak English for us, and we fired all the Arabic translators.
And we keep firing all of our translators because they're gay. I mean, it's so crazy when you.
If you wrote this story and handed
it. Really happens.
Yeah, Caro, if you wrote this story and handed it to a publisher, don't you imagine it would be thrown back in your face? Oh, this is ridiculous.
Impossible. People don't act like this. Oh,
it's just pathetic.
Comedy routine.
On a more serious note, I have not done, and I'm one of those rare talk radio people who will confess his shortcomings. I don't, you know, start the program talking about having talent on loan from God or anything. But I have done a pitiful job covering the Don Siegelman story.
Okay.
Because it is, it's so complex.
Yes, yes. But I think we can boil it down pretty well.
Apparently it's gonna hit on 60 Minutes this Sunday,
yes.
Finally.
Yeah, so people should be sure to tune in to 60 Minutes this Sunday. And this is what it is. Remember when Talking Points Memo, which has gotten an award, by the way, a journalism award for its reporting on this issue, when they started looking at the Justice Department and said, wait a minute, what are all these firings? Well, I mean, why are all these people leaving all at the same time? You know, what's going on here? And they started digging into it and digging into it more and digging into it more. They started to discover that a lot of these people were either fired or asked to resign. You know, like nine, I think, what do they call them when they're the attorney for a certain area, U.S. attorneys. They were, you know, because it started to become clear, they were fired or asked to quit because they were not using their office for political purposes. Okay, now you would think it would be the reverse.
Right, yeah, this is because they weren't dirty enough.
If you had a U.S. attorney who was prosecuting the other party needlessly or not prosecuting his own party, then, hey, you know, you get rid of that guy because that's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to be even-handed in those kinds of prosecutions. Well, it was all throughout the Justice Department, from the top down, they were trying to get these people to be more political, which is totally against everything, okay, the Constitution, everything. So anyway, more and more came out about the story, and then they found out that one of the places where the U.S. attorney did make his office more political was in Alabama. And the evidence that the office was made political was that they had gone after, indicted, tried, convicted, and sent to prison of former governor. I don't know if he was sitting governor at the time that they arrested him and indicted him. He was
Siegelman.
Siegelman
was actually running for governor at the time he was indicted.
Okay.
Yeah, this was an effort to make sure because he was on the verge of unseating Bob Riley, who is the right-wing fundamentalist governor of Alabama at present.
Okay.
Then
what he did, but you know what they did was they they indicted him for things that are not
illegal?
Either not illegal or certainly not felonies, not to go to prison for. Oh, and there were a slew of them. Oh, tons and tons of charges and indictments and whatever and whatever. The judge threw most of them out, but then allowed them to convict him on some, you know, ridiculous charges, and then sentenced him to the absolute maximum in prison that one can receive for each of the counts, and they were stacked upon each other,
and wouldn't do the thing that's most usual in these cases, and that is let the man remain at large pending appeal.
Exactly.
You know, Scooter Libby was not sent immediately to jail.
That is correct.
Upon conviction.
Nor was Duke Cunningham. Nor were any of these people sent to prison immediately, but you know this guy was because they didn't want him to. I mean, they wanted to totally destroy the guy and you know keep him out of from defeating their candidate.
Some might be surprised to hear that you know Alabama, that's kind of backwater. But of course, for those who bought the program and are paying attention, Caro, George Bush actually has Alabama connections going way back.
No, I did not know that.
Well, it was to Alabama that he fled when he went AWOL from the Texas Air National Guard.
Oh, that's right.
And it was on the Winton Blunt for Senate campaign that he allegedly worked when he was, you know, strutting around in his cowboy boots and was referred to as all hat and no cattle and was generally...
I believe that the other people working on the campaign said that all he ever did was come in around noon and complain about his headache from drinking.
From the night's drinking. But the thing is...
When he came in.
Out of that were forged relationships that resulted in federal court appointments, U.S. attorney appointments. See, all of this, the appointments that were made, all came out of Karl Rove's little black book.
My, what a tangled web.
Exactly. And so I don't know how much quality there will be in the CBS story. It's been shelved a couple of times already, so that means that pressure similar to that John McCain put on Keller at the New York Times with regard to Floozygate.
Yeah. What are you calling it?
Floozygate.
Floozygate. Other people were saying a bimbo eruption. And I said, don't call it that. That reminds people of...
right. No, this is Floozygate. And in fact, I don't know if John Fox has gotten done with it yet or not, but we have a really cool parody song in the works for this.
Good.
Hopefully it would be spread far and wide on the internet.
Good.
When we get done with it. But anyway... so it's going to be on 60 Minutes, and I'll reserve judgment till I see it, but I'm afraid it will have been watered down.
As soon as it's ready, and I'll help you promote it.
Oh, I absolutely will. but out of this also, an intriguing little link from your digest that I got today, where Larissa Alexandrovna of At Largely, and does she still write for Raw Story?
Still at the Raw Story, yeah.
Yeah. She says that she and Scott Horton and others who have written about the Siegelman case have been told that an attack, some sort of attack piece, is coming against her and Horton and anybody else who has written about this, the Siegelman political prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these guys are months away from being thrown out of office. And they are going to go down cutting and slashing all the way to the end, aren't they?
You absolutely bet. And you can also bet that they are burning the midnight oil in every single department of government, chewing up documents in the shredder machines and, you know, getting rid of stuff and also placing into executive orders and whatever, trying to perpetuate whatever shenanigans they have pulled in order to make every agency do the opposite of what it was intended for. It's going to be a huge, huge mess trying to clean up the everything that's been done to our government.
Not to minimize the suffering of anybody who went through it, but it's almost like having Katrina expand politically.
Yes.
You know what? Do you see what I'm saying? It's going to be a mess that whoever occupies the White House is going to spend 4 years cleaning up.
If only four.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, right. Yeah. And that excludes John McCain because he won't even make the effort.
I got a theory.
Okay.
Now my significant other tells me, don't say that in public. People will say you're crazy. You're some kind of conspiracy theorist or whatever. If you were George W. Bush, what would you be the most concerned about right now?
Post office indictment. I don't mean post office. I mean post being in office indictment.
Yes. Going to prison.
Yeah. In the short, yes.
Yes. So, and wouldn't you, if you were his dad, be worried about that? If you were his brother, Jeb, wouldn't you be worried about that? If you were Karl Rove, wouldn't you be worried about that?
Absolutely.
Okay. So what would be their best chance of making sure that that they don't get exposed at least for 4 years?
Have McCain in office.
Uh-huh. Or have a Republican in office.
Sure.
Now, which Republican came from absolutely nowhere, out of nothing, with no money and no ratings, to be the almost certain candidate?
Well, that's not McCain.
Yeah, because he was nowhere. I mean, he was way down in the polls.
Well, yeah, yeah. His campaign was declared DOA at one
right.
point.
Exactly.
But I,
how did he suddenly become the front runner and the almost certain candidate?
Another hug?
Or a promise?
Or three? Yeah. And see, I
will make sure that, you know, nothing happens investigate you, indict you, or put you in prison. And Daddy Bush goes along, and Jeb Bush goes, oh, McCain, he's great, he's wonderful.
So that in turn means that all of this fulminating on the hard, weird right by people like Limbaugh and Laura Ingraham and so forth is inside the Beltway Kabuki theater.
I don't know. I really don't know the whole extent of it. I just know what starts to make sense and what kind of looks like what I would be worried about this, you know, if I were in their position. So what the Limbaugh and those folks have in mind, I am not really sure. They're starting to really love Barack Obama, or at least they say they do. You know, Limbaugh. Somebody told me today on one of the email lists that I'm on, she says, it's not that I'm against Obama exactly, but I'm really for Clinton, and so I send people this stuff because of all these starry-eyed, crazy people going, oh, I love him, I love him. I said, well, do you really know what you're voting for? So I said, not this stuff. There's one woman wrote, and she said, you know, I'm getting this same stuff from my brother, who is a Rush Limbaugh fan. Are you a Republican in this Democratic group? And I said, no, but there's at least a possibility that, you know, Rush Limbaugh thinks that Obama is easier of the two Democratic candidates left to beat, and that he's saying, oh, great, you know, you Republicans, maybe you should cross over and help get this guy nominated or whatever, and then after he's nominated,
yeah, put the shank between his ribs.
You know,
yeah,
I don't know, but I'll tell you what, these are the most Machiavellian, manipulative people I have ever seen on the face of the earth, and I would believe anything about them. You know, if somebody handed me evidence that this was going on, I would say, yes, I thought so.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have any evidence, so don't call me crazy. Don't call me.
No. I understand, Carol, because there are times when I have said more than once that the other side plays chess while we play checkers.
Well, it's even more than that. The other side is at war while we're playing beanbag, according to the Marquis of Queensberry rules.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, trying to be gentlemen about it. And they're killing us.
And I think there is a perception out there that they have a tremendous, they've been working against Hillary Clinton since 1991.
Yes.
And they've made an industry out of it.
Yes.
I don't know.
And so here are all these people saying, oh, I can't stand it. I don't want her to be elected because it's going to be all that same old stuff over and over and over again. Well, do they think that these people are going to sit on their hands?
And that's what I was going to say. Do you think there's a perception among right-wing circles that Barack Obama will take the attacks and just sit back and sing kumbaya?
No,
Kerry didn't fight back?
Now, some Democrats seem to think that, but I don't think that at all, because his chief political strategist is Mayor Daley's chief political strategist. This is Chicago, please.
Yeah, these are not people. These are not people who bring knives to gunfights.
That's right. So I think he'll be a fighter, and in fact, I think that a lot of the anti, no, I can't say that. I don't know, but it's pretty strange that a lot of the anti-Hillary stuff came along right at the right time, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Anyway.
I caught a little bit of the pageant last night.
Yeah, the pageant.
Yeah, they're not debates. And I got to say that Hillary had the worst and the best of the evening, both. I thought the line about that's leadership you can Xerox was
change.
Yeah, that's change you can Xerox. I thought that was just tacky.
But on the other hand,
her closer was
very
pitch.
Good.
Perfect.
Yes.
When she said, I don't have any problems. It was and instead acknowledged
yes,
what's happening to real America.
Right.
That spoke to me.
And it was heartfelt, and she obviously really meant it, and all of that. Maybe it wasn't artful the way she put that that thing about the. You know,
it smelled desperate to me, Carolyn, quite frankly.
Think about this, though. They're not doing it well. But here's my point about the fact that Obama had taken some words from Deval Patrick. You've talked about that on your show, have you?
Only briefly. I've tried to stay away from that stuff.
Well, but here's the thing. To me, it's disingenuous at best for somebody who's coming along and saying, oh, you know, I this is what I feel, blah, 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 blah. And then you find out that those words, and it's not just Deval Patrick who was using those words. It was another person who was David Axelrod is the chief political strategist. He was a political strategist for Deval Patrick. And then another candidate previously of David Axelrod also used similar terminology. His name was John Edwards. In 2004, that was the terminology he was using. So it starts to get like...
Yeah, I saw one comment saying, gosh, did you notice that most of what Hillary had to say last night was John Edwards' work?
But she never said, I'm this brand new person, I'm this agent of change, I want to, I inspire everybody and all of that. She never pretended to be that person. You know, and yet here's Obama saying, I am that person, I'm great and wonderful and this and that, or at least his people are saying that, and then, his heartfelt words are focus group.
I don't know how much these pageants impact voter attitudes, so I don't know if it's going to have any impact on, for instance, the Texas primary.
Yeah,
her closer was definitely the out of the ballpark of the night.
Yeah, she got a standing ovation. For
Actually,
I think the standing ovation was for both of them,
mm-hmm.
And it was right at the end.
But the one thing that did impress me is I appreciated more than anything else, because it wasn't snarky and it wasn't snipey, but it was focused and it was serious. Was the interchange on health care, the back and forth, the give and take?
I didn't see the whole debate, so I didn't see that.
It was that rarest of creatures during these pageants that we've had over the last several months. It was a substantive discussion that almost resembled a debate.
Wow, amazing!
So
nobody was trying to play gotcha or anything like that.
No, it was going back and forth, and I don't think either one of them got a knockout punch.
On the healthcare thing, I have taken my cue from Paul Krugman,
right,
Princeton professor and New York Times columnist, who is an expert in healthcare, PhD expert in healthcare, has been for years, as well as trade. And he has delineated better than anybody else what's wrong with our healthcare system. And he says that Hillary's program is more progressive, and that that having a mandate, and everybody goes, oh, a mandate, that is so mean. This is another reason to hate Hillary. they don't even realize that it means that the cost per person is something like $2,700 a year instead of the $4,400 a year under Obama's plan, where 15 million people aren't covered. You know, so people, you got you know, what do you want?
And
you know?
and I think both sides of that discussion lead inexorably, Caro, at least for me, to the final analysis, which is, why are we still beating around the bush on this? The real question is why both of these candidates have not signed off on John Conyers' H.R. 676, the Medicare for All Act, and let's do it and get it done.
Absolutely. In fact, all they really have to do is to not mandate Medicare for All, but make Medicare available to all who want to buy in.
Sure.
That's all they have to do. Okay, think about this. Medicare has like 2% of its costs or of its total.
Less than 2% is administrative.
Administrative costs, okay? It only takes up 2% of its revenues for administrative costs, whereas most insurance companies is like 14 to 18%, and most of that is trying to deny people coverage.
And some of them go as high as 30 and 40% care.
It could. It certainly could.
And that's okay, taken up in advertising and quarterly dividends.
That too. Oh, and profit.
Sure.
You know, their CEOs
right.
have to make hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars a year, okay? So we ain't got no CEO there.
Yeah, whoever's
Medicare.
Yeah, whoever's running Medicare, I'm sure is handsomely compensated.
Oh, he's probably making $150,000 a year.
And that's, you know what? If we want to pay him $500,000, that's okay too.
Well, they couldn't make that much because the president only makes $400,000, so it's probably $150,000, $160,000, and that's, you know, I mean, that to me, that's what a lot of CEOs ought to be paid instead of this hundreds of millions stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the costs are so low. All right. What will happen? People will start buying Medicare instead of regular insurance. But isn't that what a free market is all about?
Well, certainly it is. And
so
that's the funny thing.
Every time, against them.
Right. Every time we get it. Every time I find a situation where, you know, you could argue this is how the free market works, it turns out it's exactly what the free marketeers don't want.
Exactly. I want a free market anywhere except in my business.
Right. But at the end of the day, Caro, what they want, and maybe this is one of those framing issues that George Lakoff talks about so much, maybe we should stop talking about these people in terms of being free marketeers. What they want are captive markets.
Exactly. Everybody wants a monopoly. Listen, if the free market were totally left to its own devices, I mean, no regulation, no worries about monopolies or anything like that, we would end up with one gigantic, huge corporation that made and sold everything. And if you wanted something they don't have, you wouldn't get it.
You don't need it. And at that point in time, it transforms itself into a Soviet-style command economy.
Exactly. You know what the name of the company would be? Micromax.
I was thinking
that's the end result of totally unregulated market, free market, if you want to call it that.
Sure it is. We've got a caller on here, Caro. Let's see who wants to add to the discussion here. Hi, who have I got?
You got Dave from Southern California.
Well, hey, Dave, how are you?
Hey, Dave.
Pretty fair. One thought that I wanted to throw out, I don't like to be pessimistic all the time, but I try to listen between the lines, and the main problem as I see it in healthcare is that the giant health insurance companies want to make a maximum of profit. They want to charge as much as they possibly can and pay out as little as they can. And people like Obama and Hillary must know that. And these insurance companies offer big bribes to any member of the legislature, the Senate, or the Congress that's willing to accept it to be their defenders. And so I hear nothing from Obama or Hillary that the problem is big, greedy insurance companies that need to be taken out of the picture. They're not saying that. So,
here's my understanding. My understanding is that the same people that fought Hillary tooth and nail in the early 90s are now with her. There's the Chamber of Commerce realizes that something has to be done, and they're with her. The AMA, all of these organizations that understand that there is this huge, gigantic, awful problem, and even some insurance company group is with this deal of changing things, you know, getting to the point where getting a control on all these crazy costs.
But it is a real pattern that's going on right now, to charge as much as you possibly can, to where most people really cannot honestly afford to have health insurance.
Absolutely. They keep telling us we're supposed to have...
And that's the thing, not to interrupt, Carol, but
sure.
Whether it's $2,700 in mandate or $4,400 in mandate, my question keeps coming up, where is it going to come from? Where are these families going to come up with it?
At the moment, it would come from individuals and their employers if their employers, you know, pay for it. Fewer and fewer are paying. But my point with, you know, letting us buy into Medicare would be this, that pretty soon 99.9, because of the lowest cost, 99.9% of people would be choosing Medicare. And once that happens, we would all say, well, why are we making this separate payment on that thing?
The last time that I had family health care through an employer, my part of it was just short of $6,000 a year.
Well, yeah, I'm paying more. Was paying more than that. I finally had to give it up. I was paying like $857 a month for me only, $5,000 deductible. It was just outrageous.
Yeah.
You know, I was getting nothing for it.
And yeah, right, because you still, at best, you get 80-20 coverage, and that's the thing that is we're finding out more and more, is that there's plenty to worry about in terms of the uninsured in this country, but the folks who have it, who have insurance, are getting crippled.
Right, because you don't want to use it, because that'll make you a bad risk, and it'll make your rate go up, and it'll make you uninsurable if you lose that insurance and have to, I mean, that's how crazy all this is. It's totally insane. Plus, think about this, okay? All of those years that I and my employers paid in, I'm a little bit older than you, paid in to an insurance company for my health insurance and never used it. You know, too bad. So sad.
And that's
yesterday. What have you done for me today?
Well, precisely, and the same thing applies to auto insurance. You can have a perfect driving record, never make a claim, and at the end, you know, there ought to be a little placard at the funeral that says this individual paid out $150,000 for car insurance that got him exactly nothing.
Nothing. Oh, I know.
Dave, anything else?
Well, I'd like very much to see somebody put the question clearly and directly to both of these candidates as to what they plan to do about these insurance companies that are bribing all of the members of Congress and overcharging the hell out of the people. So only the very rich are going to be able to have insurance. A lot of companies are going to legitimately have to relocate in another country where they don't have to pay $10,000 a year for basic health insurance. And
well, that's one of the reasons why the Chamber of Commerce is finally behind reform on this issue, because they understand that our products are more expensive because of that, other things as well, but because they have to pay health insurance on their workers, and in other countries the companies don't have to do that.
And that's going to be tacked on to the price of the car or the washing
machine
or whatever.
It certainly is.
The one made in Canada will be a lot cheaper. Thank you so much for all that you're doing.
And thank you, Dave. We appreciate the
call. To hear from you, Dave. Have a great weekend, all right?
Thank you,
Bob. Bye now. And, you know, I think Dave brings up a valid point, Caro, and that is the nature of the discussion itself.
Yes. Yes, he's absolutely right about that. But it's you know, certainly true of the insurance companies. It's also true of the pharmaceutical companies. For years, it was true of the AMA, you know, don't stop our monopoly, which they basically have on healthcare. Don't let nurses' assistants do this kind of work and stuff like that to lower the cost of doing these kinds of procedures and things like that. Everybody wants a monopoly, you know, in their little area, and then they want everybody else to not have a monopoly. And that's just healthcare, okay?
Right.
And they're all putting money in the pockets of congressmen and so on. And this is one of the things that kills me is the way it ends up happening. All of that money, or most of it, that's used for campaigns and things like that, whether we contribute or lobbyists contribute or whoever contributes, way, way much of it goes into big advertising, television advertising in particular. And most of that goes into the pockets of the very media moguls
who hate our guts,
employees so well to say bad, nasty, awful things about Democrats and good, awful, good, wonderful, great things about Republicans.
Chris, and you know, there's a story out there. I don't know about necessarily the accuracy of it or whether the editorial side of the story I don't much care about, but you know, it was campaign filing, it was campaign disclosure time recently, Caro, and there was a detailing of Senator Clinton's spending.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of stuff, I read it, and I wasn't reading it, you know, from a bad Hillary or good Hillary standpoint, because I'm just, you know, I'm going to vote for the Democratic nominee in November, and that's what's going to happen. But of the money that she had, and this is just some of the raw data out of the article, nearly $100,000 went for party platters and groceries before the Iowa caucuses. Rooms at the
that was for the voters.
Yeah, sure, and you can
voters are giving her money for her campaign, and she's buying it for.
And she's buying cheese, cheese and bologna platters with it. That part makes sense. And I guess you can spend $100,000 on Iowa, because they're caucuses and they're very personal events.
Yeah,
so therefore,
it's not like having tea and cookies available at a polling place or anything like that.
No. Now, on the other hand, though. The Bellagio Luxury Hotel in Las Vegas, $25,000.
Ugh.
$5,000 at the Four Seasons.
But did you ever see the last year of the West Wing?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah,
where they had the new race for the next president. You see how many people there were on...
And that's the thing, that this article moves along into some detailing. And again, as far as I'm concerned, this isn't about Hillary Clinton's campaign, because there are similar numbers in Obama's and anybody else's.
Right. It's about the waste.
Howard Wolfson is her communications director and a senior member of the advertising team. There we go.
That's
just what you were talking about.
Singularly. Get it? That's really bad at expressing what needs to be expressed. So
you want to know what his tab was for January, Caro?
His fee?
Yeah.
Please tell me.
$267,000 for January.
I'm surprised it isn't millions. I think.
Just January.
I think she had to pay. I think she had to pay Mark Penn a lump sum of $5 million or something like that.
He's approaching $730,000 in total billing.
Mm-hmm.
Mandy Grunewald, who is her media strategist, $2.3 million.
Wait a minute, she's got a media strategist and a media strategist. One name Wolfson and one name.
Yeah, I know. And it goes on and on. And Mandy Grunewald's firm is into the campaign for another $250,000.
You know, some of that is buying the strategists so that they don't work for the other side. You know, I mean, this is all pitiful. You think about
it. Well, you know, I think about John Kerry hiring, what's his name, Bob Schrum.
Oh, Lord, the guy that loses all his elections?
Yeah, the Washington, you know, the Washington generals of the political world. You know, gets hired to go out and get his butt handed to him by the Globetrotters every Saturday and Sunday.
And he gets paid a lot of money to do that.
And again, this isn't about Mrs. Clinton, Senator Clinton. This is about the nature of the system.
Exactly.
It is, because to be fair, Carol, to be fair.
Think about what goes on in England, for example, or France. Okay.
Or Australia.
The countries that have much better health care than we have for half the price. In those countries, first of all, there aren't any national elections. Every election is local, the way their situation is structured.
Because of their parliamentary system.
Right, but they, and therefore, there's only so much you can spend in one little riding, I think they call it. A riding is like a district for electing a member of parliament, okay? It's like a congressional district, you know, that size. So how much money can you spend other than, you know, maybe giving thousands of dollars to each voter to vote for you, you know? You can't spend it.
We used to do that here in West Virginia, you know.
And so there's no need for these big companies to try to give them money, at least for elections. Okay, now, I'm sure that there are some companies that try to give them money illegally, you know.
Sure, sure. But no, it's wildly different. And yet, you know, we have localized elections as well. Congressional districts aren't that big.
They don't elect any national office. The prime minister is elected by the parliament. So the only elections that they have are at the local level.
And to a certain extent, for all of the dog you and I could probably do an hour on this topic all by itself, Carol. But for all the ballyhoo of national campaigning for the presidency, we still don't have direct election of the president.
That is correct.
As we were shown ever so clearly in 2000, the Electoral College can invalidate the will of the people.
Correct.
So how do you look at all of these facts and not just have, you know, the clouds part and the light comes down and the heavenly angels sing and you realize that this is corporate welfare for big media?
Yes, it is.
Somebody bring me the toaster. I've won one tonight.
You know, I just want to cut through the whole thing. I just want to stop that whole mess. If we make it so that, you know, candidates don't have to spend a lot of money to get elected or can't, or that we insist that they use public financing, then that takes so much corruption out of the system. So much corruption.
Almost overnight, too.
Pardon?
Almost overnight it takes it out.
Almost overnight, right. Just like letting people buy into Medicare. Boom! Almost instantly we have taxpayer-funded health care. You know, but there are powerful interests keeping those things from happening.
They're
powerful.
Yeah, I don't think you're ever going to see Tim Russert hosting a roundtable discussion on the media's corrupting influence on the American political process.
Oh no! In fact, he's one of the lost boys. He and Tweety Bird.
Yeah, Matthews.
Chris Matthews, and I think Brian Williams is the other one. That were purposely corrupted by Jack Welch when he owned GE, which owns NBC.
Right.
You know, he purposely made those guys so rich and so wealthy that they got the message.
Yeah, I got mine, screw the rest of you.
Yeah. Well, that was part of it, but also, I know which way the wind is blowing. My boss wants me to be pro-Republican and anti-Democrat. Let's see, how can I do that and still sound like I'm not so very, very bad? I mean, it's amazing. It's just amazing. From the days of Walter Cronkite that I remember, when everybody in the country trusted that man because it never would have occurred to them that he was corrupt in any way. He probably was paid what would be the equivalent of today, maybe $100,000 or something. These guys, big guys in media, the Russerts and the Williams and the Tweety Birds, make millions of dollars a year.
And if we follow,
to be wrong.
Yeah, to be wrong. But perhaps the larger picture here, Caro, is if we track that money backwards.
Yeah.
The millions that are paid to the Russerts, the Williamses, and the Matthewses,
yep.
They're paid by NBC.
Well, some of it comes from us. You know,
that's where I'm going, because
we've said that it comes from lobbyists and whoever.
But at the end of the day, there are very dedicated people sitting at their kitchen tables writing $5 checks, $10 checks, maybe $100 checks.
Yep.
And sending it to political campaigns that political campaigns, by virtue of the system, are then compelled to give to people who are directly inimical to the needs and the issues that matter to the people sitting at those kitchen tables.
We are paying for our own demise.
Yeah,
how crazy is that?
We are sharpening the executioner's axe.
Time.
Oh, I got a good edge on this one, Ivan. You know,
it's just crazy.
and yet, it's so frustrating because also tied in with this is the idea that somehow or another, big media corporations and big corporations in general have civil rights.
Yeah,
and that somehow the. I had a question earlier today, and I was asked to go and find the origins of corporate personhood, and I found a fascinating, and of course that comes out of Santa Clara versus Union Pacific Railroad, an 1886 case.
I don't know if you have read Tom Hartman's book on that subject, but it's very, very good.
Yeah, he's exhaustive on it, and but I found a fascinating little phrase, and that is before that case, which was screwed up to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Before that case, the 14th Amendment and the Bill of Rights were deemed to be human rights,
right,
and not legal rights.
Correct.
And so only after you decide that the railroad company has the same rights as a sharecropper, actually more rights, if you know what
well,
I mean.
Well, you would say, okay, well, they have the same rights. They have the right of free speech. Well, when all of that was going on, all that argument was going on a couple of years ago, one of my readers wrote to me and said, well, does that mean if I have $1 and you have $1 million, do you have 1 million times more free speech than I have?
Well, effectively, yes.
If money is free speech, then yes.
And while corporations, corporations can only express themselves via the money that they spend. Yeah, as if they're standing out in the cold with their little frosty cheeks pressed up against the window panes, looking in at all us peons, exercising our political power. That's so much hogwash.
I bet they have a crutch like Tiny Tim too.
Yes, more please. it's that ability. You know, it's not one man, one vote.
No, it's not. Not if there's money in the system. Not if you assume that money is free speech. No, all of those things. It's not one man.
So I think you and I have done a very good job in the last 20 minutes of showing how the sort of arthritic octopus that the problem is, because it's all tangled and wrapped up together and everything. Is there a starting place in this Gordian knot, or do you just do the Alexander thing and hack at it with a sword?
Well, this is what I think. It would be great if we could hack at it with a sword, but and of course that's the kind of thing that Obama is promising, and I just don't think it can be done. I think that the chipping away idea that Clinton almost sort of, says that's the way we'd have to do it, by rolling up our sleeves and getting it done. That's part of it. But there's another issue, too, and that is both of the candidates that are left to us are pretty corporatist, okay? I know that comes as a surprise to a lot of people that support Obama, but trust me, he's my senator. I know this, okay?
Sure.
And so what the two guys that were really populist get shoved out of the race. I mean, they would just...
No, they got run.
You know, and could not possibly have made it. In fact, I was an Edwards supporter at first. So my belief is that we need to start at lower levels. And there are a couple of organizations doing this. One is the Progressive Majority, and another is Democracy for America.
Right. I get their newsletter.
Yeah, it was the successor to the Dean campaign, and is now run by his brother, Jim Dean. Those kinds of efforts to put progressives, real progressives, into office, and people who believe that reform of the system is needed, people who believe that you shouldn't have to have millions of dollars to run a damn congressional campaign, people who believe these things strongly, and get enough of those people into office to start making a difference. But it's going to take a long time. See, people don't realize that the takeover of the Republican Party that basically started with a memorandum by Lewis Powell in 1971, it took 30 years before they were able to put somebody in the White House, okay, that movement. Now
And the religious right is even older than that.
Well, yeah, all right.
Paul Weyrich, 1968 or so.
Yep. But right around that time, the religious right, the neocons, the corporacons, as I call them, all had a similar enlightening experience, and all said, geez, we could all get together. We could, and that's when they started.
We could screw America forever.
I know.
Wouldn't that be fun?
And we could get so rich.
Well, okay, as far as the mechanics of doing it, though, what do you think of this idea?
How do I think it is done?
No. Well, I was gonna put an idea to you and see what you think.
Okay.
What do you say we let the corporations do it themselves? And by that I mean we create a system whereby we have a two-track corporate structure in America. On the one hand, you can be a corporation and pay corporate tax rates, or you can be a fully functioning corporate person and pay personal income tax rates.
I'm not sure what would be the advantage there.
Well, on the one hand...
The corporation could be the person.
The corporation is the person.
Pay a higher rate of taxes.
And they pay... And
they're not a person.
Right. But if they choose the corporate track... They don't have any free speech. They don't have any right. They don't have any Bill of Rights rights.
Right. Well, certainly that's an important factor in what has to be done. But I really think that the main goal toward reducing the corrupting power of money in politics will have to be public funding of campaigns. And sorry, but it's going to have to be a mandate. You don't get a choice. You know, you can't be the candidate that goes out to Exxon or whoever and gets billions of dollars to obliterate your competition. Okay, everybody that wants to run for office, that the only qualification is a number of signatures on a petition. If you can get enough people together to go out and get your signatures on the petition, you're in, you qualify. So that we get people like school teachers and bus drivers and folks like that.
Or maybe scientists.
Scientists, yeah, into the system, but right now we've got millionaires. It's
and not very smart ones.
And not...
it's not the position that I object to, it's the intellect, or lack thereof.
And the intellectual curiosity and the ability to base decisions on facts as opposed to wishes and ideologies. I mean, it sounds so simple.
But I think our discussion proves, Caro, that this is not an intractable, insoluble problem.
No, not at all. It is not insoluble. But for right now, I think, rather than think any big national leader is going to come in and save us or anything like that, I'm sorry, it ain't going to happen. That the way to do it is to get down in the trenches, in local elections even, you know, but certainly at the congressional level, get the people in there that will, you know, that will worry about us, the people. I mean, really worry about us. We have a lot of folks that say they're worrying about us, and then they get corrupted.
Yeah, and there's a big difference between worrying about the, you know, inevitably about this time of year you start seeing those photographs that show up in you know, the weekly moral volcano and battle cry of freedom, whatever newspaper is handy, that shows, you know, Congressman Slugenstein standing there with the big golf check, you know, the check that's 4 feet wide by 2 feet tall.
Yeah.
For the local volunteer fire department or whatever.
Vince said I'm going to get from my lottery one of these days so that I can do things like fund the Head on Radio Network. And
oh, if you knew the number of people playing lottery numbers out there for that, exactly. you know, I got to get out there and get the ticket every week because that's my retirement plan, Carol. Yeah, it's the only one the Bush administration hasn't managed to ruin yet.
Well, so far, yeah.
But they show up in the paper with these big checks and everything. But then you look and you say, well, what legislation did you write? And that's part of it too, is getting the lazy out of Congress. This idea of letting K Street write the legislation, or any special interest group, you know, actually having representatives with the brains to write a law,
or to hire the staff smart enough to actually do the writing of the law, but you do the telling. This is what's important. These are the people that we want to make sure are taken care of. We want to do this, this, that, and that, and that, and have somebody else sit down and write the actual legislation, some law student or something, you know. There's a lot that needs to be done. So, there's a lot to be optimistic about. You know, there's no reason for us to say, oh, it's intractable, nothing can be done, blah, blah, blah. It's not true.
No, and that's something I got out of both candidates last night. Granted, neither of the two stood up and said, you know, I'm personally going to fly the plane out that takes our troops away from Iraq. But in both Hillary's closing and in the body of the discussion, there was enough discussion to make me think that both of these people are serious about ending the Iraq occupation.
I believe that they both are. I really do.
And frankly, at one point, Hillary had made me a little bit nervous because she was saying that, you know, we need to leave troops in there like we've got them in Korea. And I think she's come away from that, perhaps.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, anybody who looks at our economy,
yeah,
realizes,
exactly,
you know, this is having not only an indirect, but now a direct impact.
Exactly.
On our ability to be us.
Exactly.
Well, Caro, what a wonderful, wonderful hour you have given us, and I sincerely appreciate it. God willing, there won't be any more bad neck muscles or flu bugs or, I don't know, grim, creeping, debilitating diseases running through the studio anytime soon. Knock wood. Oh, God, where's the wood? Hang on.
do please, Michael.
Yeah, because, you know, this thing, it's a pasteboard, and I don't think that counts in the cosmic luck thing. we'll do this again next Friday night. And in the meantime, I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Stay warm, stay dry, and keep setting them up and knocking them down.
All righty. Same to you.
All right. Thanks, Caro.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. From MakeThemAccountable.com, Carolyn Kay. I love these little conversations. And thus we have done away. We have put into the great hopper of broadcast history another hour of fabulous programming. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. We'll take a little break and come back. I am told that this is an absolutely fabulous song. We're going to find out. Thanks to ELO, our moderator in the chat room, for this. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice, America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn, and I'm Bob Kincaid.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Change to Win Labor Federation is endorsing Senator Barack Obama for president. Four unions within the federation, the SEIU, the Teamsters, UFCW, and Unite Here, had already individually endorsed Obama. But the other Change to Win unions, the Carpenters, the Laborers, and the United Farm Workers, all abstained from this vote to endorse Obama. United Farm Workers spokesperson Vicky Adami says the farm workers are sticking with their endorsement of Senator Hillary Clinton.
We continue to support Senator Clinton for her run for president. We are working in Texas to organize people and getting out the vote. We listened to our farm worker leadership, and what we heard from them was that they overwhelmingly believed that Senator Clinton was the one who would best look after their interests, look after farm worker issues, just not just, you know, our members, but across the nation.
Ohio has become the key battleground state in the race for the Democratic nomination. The big question is, how will the candidates react to a new study showing Ohio's job losses since 2000 are worse since the Great Depression? Jesse Russell reports.
As the two candidates prepare to slug it out in Ohio, a new report from the American Manufacturing Trade Coalition suggests that trade talk should become the main part of any of their speeches. Ohio, according to the coalition, has seen a decline in non-farm jobs of 3.7% since the end of 2000. That is the biggest seven-year decline since the state started keeping track in 1939, at the end of the Great Depression. Nine of Ohio's major metropolitan areas, including Springfield, Canton, and Dayton, have watched jobs decline between 4 and 10% since 2000. Of those jobs lost, 23.3%, or 236,000, were in the manufacturing industry. According to the report, the jobs that were lost were the ones that could easily be exported out of the country. Springfield was hit the hardest, with nearly 47% of that city's manufacturing jobs vanishing. Overall, the United States has seen a manufacturing job decline of 19.8% since 2000. Here is today's economic report. The state of Massachusetts had a rough month of January. Nearly 800 foreclosures were recorded in the first month of 2008, up 128% since January 2007. According to a report from the Warren Group, Massachusetts saw an increase of petitions to foreclose during the month of December. 2,729 petitions were filed, up 28% from the previous year, suggesting that the next couple of months in Massachusetts could continue to be bumpy for the housing market.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Eleven minutes past the hour. That's early enough in the hour to call this hour number two, isn't it? Let us not stand on dogma. It's hour two. And it's follow-up time, catch-up time. For the past couple of nights and on many and various and sundry radio programs, there have been discussions of the sick, sexually harassing, predatory freak Bill O'Reilly and his suggestion that he would like to lynch Michelle Obama. Well, Mr. O'Reilly would like for you to know that he's sorry if you misunderstood him. That's right. That's what passes for an apology from Bill O'Reilly. I'm sorry if my statement offended anybody. Sons of bitches. They are so far removed from anything resembling the truth or basic human decency that even when they get caught in something as sleazy as suggesting a willingness to commit a murder against the wife of a presidential candidate, the best he can do is say sorry if his statement offended anybody. No, Bill, you're sorry you made the statement. But, see, that's the thing. He's not sorry. Not in the least. Let's go to the phones. Hi, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bob. It's Peter.
Oh, my God.
I'm so glad to be able to talk to you. I'm not 100%, but I feel a lot better.
You sound considerably better than the couple of times I've talked to you in the recent past.
Yeah, I'm just calling your show to shamelessly promote myself. I wanted to thank all the news ninjas and the listeners to the show that I do after yours for all sending all the nice notes and news articles, because I have been so out of touch this week. And I will be back Monday. Saw the doctor today, and I'm on the mend. And I got to tell you, Bob, I don't know how you and Agnes survived this stuff. This stuff was from the heart of hell.
Oh, it's evil. It is just vile. And the fact of the matter is, I don't know how anybody's getting through this. This is, and you know, I mean, it, there it is in Tallahassee. I got it in West Virginia. I've heard it, and this is apparently the bug that the flu shot doesn't cover.
Well, I think it doesn't. I had a flu shot, and then I took Tamiflu at the beginning of this, and I've got to say that even with all those precautions, this stuff knocked me down to the very ground. I was crawling out of bed, miserable.
Oh, it's a gut punch, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is, and I've just missed everybody terribly, and look forward to seeing everybody back Monday. The doctor I saw him today said I'm getting better, but the throat is still red. And said if I didn't want to get laryngitis, I needed to keep my mouth shut. But I could talk.
Now, that's a tough thing to tell you to do.
Yeah, I know. As if. Yeah, all you got to do is mention the Bush Library, and that'll put it like putting a quarter in. You just walk away.
Yeah, and then the laryngitis sets in just from the initial screaming.
Oh, my. Well, anyway, I won't stay on the phone, Bob. I just want to say hello to you and to everybody and tell you guys I haven't died. Or contrary to the rumors, I have not died. I'm still alive somewhere in the rural South.
Yeah, Mark Twain, the rumors of my death are greatly exaggerated.
Absolutely.
Peter, I'm so glad you're on the mend, and I don't want you to strain your throat, but I know I'm glad to hear from you, and I know the rest of the audience is too, because, it's a little family we've created here. And that's what makes it so charming and such a joyous thing to do.
We have.
I think it was one of the last shows you were on the air. You kept repeating, "Have I told you lately how much I love my job?"
Well, yeah, I did. I sort of do. You know, I sort of do. Even at half the money, I would just love my job.
Well, I was going to say, if you're not back Monday, we're cutting your pay.
Okay. I love you, and I'll talk to you guys later.
All right. Take care, Peter.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye. Good to hear from Peter. And for those of you who've had it, you know what he's talking about. This is just a grimy, filthy, nasty, evil little bug. But thank God there's no evolution, because, you know, this is just the same old flu bug, you know, over and over again. It's we got it because we're sinful, not because it's evolved and changed or anything. But you understand. We got it because God's mad at us. No, just so you can hear it for yourself. Oh, God. You might want to hear the O'Reilly apology. It's just, the O'Reilly non-apology.
On Michelle Obama this week, and tons of calls on the radio factor. As you may know, I believe Mrs. Obama was only referring to politics when she said that for the first time in her adult life, she is proud of her country. Now, if you look at both...
Still can't quite get the quote right, Kenny. Really proud. Makes a difference, but that's me.
Of the speeches that she made, and I have, the context is purely political. So I defended Mrs. Obama on both radio.
He said he was willing to lynch her. That's defending? I'd hate to see him go on the offensive.
On TV. While talking to a radio caller, I said there should be no lynching in the case. I comment off Clarence Thomas, saying he was the victim of a high-tech lynching. He said,
"Oh, okay. Well, it's all clear now, Bill O. You were just can't. This is the personal responsibility crowd, and yet they cannot take personal responsibility for a blessed thing that they say." He suggests he's willing to lynch the wife of a presidential candidate, and then palms it off on poor little tiny-brained Clarence Thomas. Pop Can Thomas. Ah, it's his fault. Yeah, okay, got it.
Then on 60 Minutes, you may remember. I'm sorry if my statement offended anybody. That, of course, was not the intention. Context is everything.
We're up to our eyeballs in context. I mean, we're just swimming in it. And in the context of what he said, just for the sake of reminding people, he said, I don't want to go on a lynching party against Michelle Obama unless there's evidence, hard facts, that say this is how the woman really feels. If that's how she really feels, that America is a bad country or a flawed nation, whatever, then that's legit. What's legit? Okay, Grandmother Kincaid, we will diagram the sentence. What does that's legit modify? Why, look, kiddies, that's legit modifies go on a lynching party. In other words, the lynching party is legit unless it meets certain standards arbitrarily established by Grand Kleagle O'Reilly. Context is everything, my little aching left hind foot. So I'm sorry if my statement offended anybody. Eat me raw, Bill O'Reilly. So, you know, I thought you might like to have the update. But there are far more significant and far more serious things at work out there. Not the least of which, some interesting legal wranglings rolling out of the Supreme Court this week. Oh, a quick update before we do that. Just because. I was in the grocery store the other day. I admit it. I had a hankering for a Reuben. So I went to the bread shelf, and granted, this is rural West Virginia, so finding a really, really good loaf of old-school Jewish deli rye, not so likely. But, you know, you can get close. You know, close enough for a hillbilly Reuben. And I found the one loaf of rye bread on the rack, and Bread Guy was there, unloading his pallets. And I said to him, I asked him, you know, is there any? No, I'm not on the truck this week. Yeah, that's right. I got the one loaf of rye bread allocated to Fayette County, West Virginia, north of the New River. Really. And he said, and by the way, because I just looked down at the price of that and the $2 for a package of 8 hot dog buns. Yeah, really. And just kind of went, you know, that Kramer face. And he said, hey, you like it now. He said, my boss has already told me today that we can expect to be charging $4 a loaf for regular bread come summer. That should sink in. We should pay attention to these things because in the midst of our worries about who said what and who flung dung in the political pageant process, going unnoticed is the notion of $4 a gallon milk, $4 plus, and bread on the way to $4 a loaf. And then this story from the Daily Independent Bangladesh Commercial Times and Moral Volcano. Okay, I added the Moral Volcano part. That's only because I'm a Mark Twain fan. Headline, Worldwide Shortage of Rice Shoots Prices Soaring. Let me repeat. Worldwide Shortage of Rice Shoots Prices Soaring as the price of rice climbs across South Asia, farmers and millers in Thailand are sitting on stocks and waiting for it to rise even further. An exporter told the Straits Times, "In my 25 years of trading, I have never seen such a bad position. There is a rice shortage in Bangladesh and China, too, among other countries, while there is a wheat shortage in Afghanistan. In local markets in Pakistan, the price of rice has gone up over the past month by more than 60% year on year. From Kansas to Kabul, high rice and wheat prices are worrying officials and economists and beginning to hit consumers, especially, and I would add more particularly, tens of millions of poor people." Because, you see, if a box of super sugar-frosted chocolate bomb cereal goes to $12.50 a box, it is not going to impact the Rockefellers, or the Bushes, or Jack Welch at GE, or the chairman of Goldman Sachs, or the CEO of Snake Farm, because cereal could go to $2,000 a box, and they still wouldn't notice it. On the other hand, the difference between a $2 loaf of bread and a $4 loaf of bread for the average, you know, makes about $30,000, $29,000 a year West Virginia family is a calculus that means less bread gets eaten. And bread is called the staff of life for a damned good reason. Because without it, you can't get along. And we're fast approaching a place where some comical little something or other like this has a certain reality. A reality that is going to be hard to contemplate.
Jesus. I don't know what people are going to do when a six-pack of Budweiser costs $1,200.
Oh, they'll be off?
Yeah, somebody tell Homer Simpson that his duff's going up. Or you Budweiser drinkers out there, hello? The single largest consumer of rice in the United States is Anheuser-Busch. Kind of why I'm so fond of the Reinheitsgebot, the German beer purity law. Water, hops, yeast, and barley. There's your beer recipe. Doesn't say nothing about no rice, Mr. Bush. That's the Bush with the C between the S and the H. Worth paying attention to. $100 a barrel oil? Yeah, that's going to have an impact. But a shortage in rice and wheat? That is the stuff that biblical famines are made of. Sorry, I don't mean to be so terribly pessimistic. Let's go to the phones and ease my pessimism. Hi, who have I got?
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Hey, Preston, how are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm not sure I'll be able to ease your pessimism, but because sometimes I know that gloomy space very well. And you can certainly see, you know, aspects of this world that are really coming apart. And
well, yeah, and it's not because I just wander through my life being negative norm.
But it's something that's on the minds of a lot of us. You know, we're afraid to talk about it almost, you know, because we're not supposed to, you know, be distraught.
Well, yeah, consider the food stamp family. Who gets $3 per person per day. One person on food stamps would have to spend an entire day's ration of food and then some just for a loaf of bread.
Yep. And they are being forced into these underground markets to make ends meet. Maybe prostitution or cannabis sales.
Yeah. Oh, it's interesting. It's interesting that you would mention something like prostitution, because I've got a news story. It's a local news story here about one of our and this fellow actually fancies himself a liberal, Preston. One of our local state senators has sponsored a bill stating that in strip clubs in West Virginia, the patrons can get no closer than 6 feet to the dancers, and lap dances are forbidden. Now, this is not a joke, and this is not me trying to find the opportunity to wedge in a little bit of tawdry blue humor.
Mm-hmm.
But anybody who has ever been in a strip joint knows that those women make their money on tips. And it's the dollar bills tucked in the little garter on the leg, and it's the lap dances, frankly, where they make their money. And so what this moral, upstanding, godly, so-called liberal state senator has done is effectively propose a law that would have the dancers dance naked for free.
Hmm. Yeah. I heard that some sex industry workers in Colombia were forming a union, or had formed a union, for certain protections and health care and stuff like that. It's a booming industry in these times with the other sorts of job cuts, the attack on government jobs, which are often, you know, provide some economic security for people, some
right.
security, union options, that sort of job being lost. So, I don't know. I became hopeful during parts of last night's debate, actually. We were speaking about pessimism, but on optimism, you know, it's nice to hear presidential candidates talk about things like green-collar jobs, getting our scientists and engineers to work on jobs that we could, that we believe in, that we could feel proud of.
And that can rejuvenate an economy.
Yes, you bet.
Because Detroit is not going to get well overnight, Preston. And none of the old brick-and-mortar nuts-and-bolts jobs that we so fervently wish we still had are going to be coming back anytime soon. So, you know, finding places to rejuvenate the economy, and I think the green sector is one of the prime examples, should be high on the list of anybody aspiring to the White House. And I hope that Senators Clinton and Obama are as serious about it as they have said they are.
Yeah. You know, and making it a reality very much depends on the citizens being more serious about it as well. I mean, really doing the advocacy that's required, speaking out, demanding the funding from the representatives, and just discussing the ideas in coffee shops, you know. That's how movements, you know, they take so many different forms. It's political level elections, and it's also just infinite number of things going on in the grassroots, in the business section, government sector, and just among citizens. But anyway, actually, you bring to mind something Hillary Clinton was doing. I know Obama suggested $210 billion for such a program.
Mm-hmm.
Hillary, I saw her speak in Cincinnati at a Lockheed Martin plant. And she said, you know, things about defense, so-called defense and weaponry that I don't agree with. But there was a part of her speech in which she said, you know, we can apply your skills, she's speaking to Lockheed engineers, towards these dual-use technologies that we can use, such as solar, and for creating energy. And I thought that was really good of her to speak to that audience, you know. You know, the scientists who, you know, Eisenhower said we should not waste their efforts either on,
right.
on so much destructive applications of our skills. I mean, cluster bombs and all that kind of thing. Horrible.
Oh, it is. And you mentioned cluster bombs. I saw a comparison the other day, Preston. And the vote on cluster munitions, and it was one of those very disturbing things. Senator Obama, and I don't know how much impact the vote had because of when it was taken. It was something that was good. It was probably purely ceremonial. I hate to say that on an issue like that.
Yeah, it can be symbolic, but
Senator Obama voted for an end to the use of cluster munitions.
Great.
Senator Clinton voted against an end of the use of cluster munitions.
That's a shame. You know, and that sort of critique of Clinton and her administration needs to be said. And, you know, frankly, I wish, you know, Rush Limbaugh, they critique the Clintons constantly, but they never got to stuff like this, you know, serious critiques. And similarly, I've heard some unfair critiques of the Clinton administration, which seems to be almost, it supplants the more serious critiques like that you offer. And I have to give an example. You know, yesterday, the debate, Clinton misspoke, certainly. But to spend 3 hours on that one mistake, that one bad choice, whatever it was, to talk about the plagiarism issue again.
Oh, my aching back.
Yeah. And I think, you know, rightly, she was rebuked for that by the audience. So there was that exchange. But other than that...
And she but it was clear that she... Okay, I'm not trying to be cheap here, Preston. But it was clear that she was sitting on that line. That was a written line. That was one that she was proud of.
Yeah. Yep.
You know what it reminded you know what
to say.
You know what it reminded me of more than anything, Preston?
What's that?
It reminded me of the cheesy little line that Truman Capote used to critique Jack Kerouac's On the Road. I think it was On the Road. It might have been Howell. It might have been Ginsberg. But you know, so-called beatnik writing, and. Truman Capote was said to have remarked, "That's not writing, that's typing."
Okay.
And, you know, that's leadership you can Xerox, or change you can Xerox, or whatever. It was just icky.
Speaking of Capote, did you happen to see that film, Capote?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Okay. It was. But the issue had been brought up several days before. And it was spoken about then. And, yes, I agree with the criticism. But so many other things were going on in that debate. More serious criticisms. You know, I think there, the discussion of Cuba was, you know, so judgmental towards them. It's always their tyranny, their communists.
Oh, I hate the Cuba discussion.
Yeah.
And I'll go ahead and say this and probably piss somebody off. I am so tired of the South Florida Cubans.
Okay, I understand that.
Are they just killing time in South Florida and don't really want to be Americans? Just waiting for their chance to go back to the mother island? I don't know. But the weight that the manifestly screwed up foreign policy that we have created. Largely out of a political desire to placate that individual niche interest.
Yeah.
Just makes me crazy.
Again, they've just been very active, a very active community. They had a lot of money, you know, that they, you know, they were making so much in Cuba.
Yeah, apparently they didn't get to keep the tobacco farms, but they got to bring the money with them. Or maybe it had been squirreled away in a Swiss bank or something.
Yeah, and maybe the sex trade again.
Yeah, and see, that's one of the things that gets under my skin about Cuba. Cuba could have been solved while I was in diapers. But instead, we got our backs up and dug our heels in and got all redneck about it. You know, very few people in considering the Cuba discussion, Preston, ever recall that we were the first government to recognize Castro.
right?
The United States was. But then, because people got all up in arms because he was into land reform and redistribution of wealth, we've all seen The Godfather, right?
And nationalization of industry.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
but it could have been cured. It could have been solved. And I don't mean by poisoning Fidel Castro's beard either. We have been reduced. Cuba has made us look like fools.
You know, and we have all seen The Godfather, and we've all seen The Sopranos. You know, that's kind of a, you know, I think it's kind of a narrative that people are certainly encouraging upon us. And I thought it was interesting that Bill and Hillary did that scene early on where they were kind of mimicking the last scene of The Sopranos. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it's amazing. And then the embargo comes and the attempted invasion, the Bay of Pigs. And we never apologize for this stuff we do. I mean, at some point, other colonial countries, France, they have a point of reckoning.
Australia just did it.
Exactly. Well, finally apologizing to the Aboriginal people. You know, although, in fairness to this country, we don't totally miss it. We have, for instance, opened a Native American museum, I think, in D.C.
I'd love to go see that sometime, by the way.
Me too. But it doesn't get the huge public publicity that it should get, you know.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't get the visitorship that the Holocaust Museum gets.
Right.
And yet the stories are shockingly, tragically similar.
Yep. The Native American Holocaust. Yes.
Let me back up to Cuba just for a minute, because you've opened a door on something that I haven't talked about for a couple of days, Preston, I think bears discussion. And that is, I grieve for Cuba. I genuinely grieve for Cuba. I wish there was some way I could travel there right now and see it now before the free market gates open up and hell yawns wide onto that poor little island. Because there's a lot that Cuba does not have. But there's a lot that it does have that is precious and to be cherished, and that will disappear almost overnight the minute the free market enters that place.
The so-called free market, yeah.
Yeah. There's the culture itself, the way that people have learned to get along with what they've got. 1954 Plymouths running on kerosene engines that have been built by nothing but Cuban sweat and engineering and determination. It's almost an automotive museum.
Yeah.
The food culture, the music culture,
the national defense they do, and not just in terms of military, although that's there to a degree.
Their healthcare system is going to be taken away from them.
That sort of defense. That's national defense.
Yeah. That's national security.
Yeah, yeah. It's also in the form of when they had a major hurricane hit. It may have been Category 5, at least 4. Destroyed like 20,000 homes. You know, some destruction very similar to Katrina. No one died.
Yeah, because they were moved to the hills, yeah. Because there was an appropriate governmental response. I'm not competent to talk about what Fidel Castro's failings have been or shortcomings, but it certainly seems to me that on an island of that size, with a population that size, that had enough people decided that he was the monster we have made him out to be, that we most assuredly could count on having seen an overthrow. It's not like we haven't funded one.
Right, right. And other things. I mean, they've accused us of all sorts of economic warfare. I mean, we have, you know, planes have been blown out of the sky, hotels bombed, destruction of agriculture, and they accuse us of kind of biological warfare, killing some of their cattle. Iraq has suggested the same thing.
We've tried to destroy their cigar industry.
Yep.
And largely failed. I mean, that's what I mean. There are amazing things down there that I would love to see. They've managed to protect significant portions of their prehistoric cultural heritage. They also have terrible, terrible environmental problems. But again, those environmental problems have been foisted, have been created in large part because of our refusal to be a part of the solution and our insistence on being part of the problem.
Yeah, and we're also, so often we're talking about if there are going to be solutions, it's going to be something we develop. But, you know, there are other people in other countries approaching their problems their own way. In Cuba, you know, while they've had so many problems, and when the Soviet Union collapsed, they lost virtually their only supplier of fossil fuels and parts for all this farm equipment and stuff. And during what was called the special period, the 10 years of kind of economic struggle that followed, on average, Cuban people lost 20 pounds. But they responded to this threat in amazing ways.
Well, they responded to it as a people who were being made war upon tend to respond, and that is by gathering themselves together, pressing themselves in upon and reaching for the character that lies deep within any sort of national soul. It should be, in fact, a textbook for anybody who still thinks attacking Iran would be a good idea. When you attack the national identity of a place, you tend to strengthen the national identity of that place.
Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to say. There are times when those communities get broken apart, though, too, and just really, I mean, genocidal-type attacks if people aren't organizing and stuff. But it's interesting. So when Castro gets disregarded or labeled, you know, communist dictator, totalitarian, all that stuff, we're attacking more than him. We're attacking the people, the entire movement. You know, a lot of people have criticisms of him, but they're generally glad for getting rid of Batista, and they're glad for their health care and so forth.
They're glad for their literacy rate. They have a literacy rate that is vastly higher than that of the United States. They have a maternal mortality rate that is vastly lower than that of the United States. They have an infant mortality rate that is vastly lower than that of the United States. And that's not just their well-to-do. That is their poorest of the poor.
And they're sending doctors all over the world.
Yes. And we're not talking about grass skirts and the bones through the nose either.
So for us to, you know, back to that conversation they had about it and what's said about Cuba generally, you know, for us to talk about how, well, they've got to do this, that, the other thing before we meet with them. I mean, please.
Who are we to say that they have to have democratic reforms? What if upon Fidel Castro's passing, they decide they want to have a king, an absolute monarchy?
Right.
Who are we to tell them that democracy is the thing for them?
Yep. That's a good question.
That's nothing but arrogance. And God knows I don't want them to have some American-style democracy, because our American-style democracy isn't working so well right now.
Yep. And speaking of political prisoners, let's talk about the Cuban Five, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know all the details of that story. Angela Davis and others have worked on it, though, and Alice Walker, and written about it. And, yeah, political prisoners. We've got our own to discuss. And so it's interesting. Oh, I also wanted to mention, before I let you go, on PBS, there's been something called E Squared. Actually, Bob, there's something else I need to talk about. I want to get back to that biological warfare thing and not to, you know, get back to pessimism, but I've been lying. I need to share this.
Okay.
To be more specific, what happened in Iraq when we, you know, after the Gulf demolition won, and the imposition of sanctions, a fly appeared in Iraq called the screw worm fly, and apparently has this parasite that is given, and it had never been seen in the region before.
Leishmaniasis?
Maybe. I don't know. But anyway, it was the cattle population was being decimated, and since the trade sanctions were on, they couldn't get any vet medicine, but for one country, and that was the Sudan. That plant that we bombed, it was in an aspirin factory, as Rush Limbaugh has asserted for years. It was making vet medicine and also anti-malarial drugs, which without those, thousands of people have died. So,
And you hope, and there's that sneaky word, and it is sneaky, Preston, because we can hang so much on it and so easily have those hopes dashed. But you hope that with either a Clinton or an Obama in office, that these issues can at least be brought to their attention, and you know that they'll at least think about it some. You know that with John McCain, it will not matter a tinker's damn.
Yeah,
sorry, I don't mean to be a bummer, but it just is.
Well, hopefully we can get people like that more focused on green energy, and he is speaking on those issues, and he believes climate change is real, and let's say we're wrong, and it's not. Let's hope we're wrong, and it's not. Well, at least let's be prudent, and if we're wrong, well, we're left with this new energy system, and he's right, and he's also said no drilling in Anwar. That's huge.
It is, but George Bush, before he went into office, Preston, said that there would be a cap on CO2 emissions.
Right.
And as quickly as he got into office, he did an about-face because he was taken into the back room and shown the writing on the wall.
Yeah. Or there'll be some new crisis, and there probably will be, either authentic ones or created ones, and they'll exploit those for saying, well, you know, we were going to do that, but, you know, of course, now we've got to drill in Anwar. Let's say Hugo Chavez, for example, does say, you know, we're going to deal with other countries that aren't always threatening us. That's how China's made so much progress. They're using soft power more often. They're certainly not saints at all, but there are areas of their foreign policy.
Right, and they're saying, listen, you're not under no threat of invasion by us. Yeah, they are, and you're absolutely right. They're leveraging that soft power. Meanwhile, we seem to, we see all of our problems as nails, and therefore all of our solutions are hammers.
Yeah. And I think there are people in the military, like General Wesley Clark, who, again, there are criticisms that can be sent, you know, with some of his choices, say, in Yugoslavia. But I was fascinated to see that he blurred the book by Chris Hedges, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. And in that book, Hedges goes into kind of the what can be some of the emotional appeals of war, you know, the camaraderie that takes place between people, the things they do accomplish, and a sense of self-sacrifice for a larger whole, and so on and so forth. And then, of course, there are the economic, you know, people like that. Who was the person who was the soldier who was captured? I'm a soldier too. She was from West Virginia.
Not Lindy England, the other one. Yeah.
Right. And before, when she was asked why she joined the military, she said something like, "There isn't even a Walmart in our town."
Yeah.
So regarding work options, you know.
Yeah, she did. She did it because she believed the pitch about making enough money for college. Hey, Preston, I need to roll on. I've got a few stacked up here, but
speaking to you, Bob.
Oh, jump in any time. Always enjoy our chats.
Yeah, we'll be in touch.
All right, take care. Bye now. Let's see. Onward and upward. Oh, wait a minute. I did that wrong. There we go. Oh, you bailed out on me. Hi, who have I got?
Well, I didn't bail.
Okay. Hey, David.
Hey, what's up?
How's it going?
Fine. I was just listening to your conversation with Preston and talking about and thinking about the right-wing radio effects that have on people, and I witnessed something that pretty much we're going to start seeing a lot of. One of the things that one of my friends who I call the evil conservative, he has one of these friends who listens to right-wing radio, and he takes it to task. And anyways, he came in with his box, and he wanted to show his latest purchases of guns. And I asked him, I said, why? So are you going to sell these? He goes, no, these are my stockpile. Like, your stockpile. And it's like, do you really think that's going to do anything against a force if we do have a police state enacted here? And he was like, well, I don't want them coming after my family and my children. Then he told me something that was it made me think of I don't know if many people know this, but with the situation with Rwanda, the reason why this was on, I believe, a documentary, the reason why people went so nuts so fast was basically their right-wing radio media was telling them constantly to kill, 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 kill. Now, I'm not saying that they're saying that yet on the airwaves, but what I'm saying is it's like one step up the stairs, if you get what I'm saying.
I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things, though, that was really an interesting analysis watching this kind of reaction. I was like, started talking about Barack, and he says, I don't believe in the Bible and all that crap. He goes, but there's a verse in there. He goes, and you would swear Barack was the Antichrist.
Like, oh no!
You just sit there and go, what? And
I feel like a Cassandra because that, you know, I keep trying to hammer that home.
Yeah, I know. Well, the amazing thing is that I don't think people understand, and it's exactly what Patton Oswalt was talking about. When your life is crap, people, and you don't have anything, and going the way you planned, You need a screw up guy to look at and go, wow, that guy says all of that, and he doesn't get the same way they look at he was going on about what this president was doing. He wasn't really a fan of it, but he was really he told me some of the books he read, and one of them was again, it's the virus in this country that we're dealing with that I don't think a lot of people understand. It really has to do with some people who are constantly being hammered psychologically and constantly being oppressed, I guess. You know what, Bob? It is cultural oppression if you think about it, because what you're doing is you're centering around on three colors, the red, white, and blue, and you're telling them, all right, now put that on your wall. And just focus on that. Keep focusing. And there's nothing else out there. So to me, in a larger sense, it is cultural oppression that we're experiencing all around. And that's why a lot of Mexicans on the streets or a lot of immigrants, they won't have their cultural symbols as easily displayed as the American flag.
Oh, don't you remember the right-wing hissy? When those marches took place and people had the unmitigated temerity to fly the Mexican flag?
Yeah. You know, just listening to him, though, he did say, guess one of the books that he said you should check out?
Okay.
Jonah Goldberg's Liberal Fascism.
Oh, stop it.
You see, I don't think people understand that everyone needs an enemy, and it just so happens that the right wing.
See, these right wing books, David, are for people who have no learning in history, no learning in politics.
The
people who read Jonah Goldberg are like people you could hand Kool-Aid and tell them it's orange juice because they've never had the real thing and therefore can't tell the difference.
I know. That's why that's why I was telling you that, to me, I believe that the – I don't care what anyone says, Bob. The airwaves are for everyone.
Sure they are.
You should not – you know what? The real
thing – I don't think I've ever said anything to the contrary, David.
I know. It's not what I'm saying to you. What I'm saying would benefit everyone. And what I'm saying is this is the reason, you know, the reason why Jimi Hendrix got on the airwaves was because of a radio station in Europe. I don't know if you know the story, Bob, but it was because people wanted to hear Hey Joe, and they created their own pirate waves to get people to hear it. So you would get the pirate radio transmission, like, oh, you got to hear Jimi Hendrix, because if you brought that to the radio station,
never get played.
A lot of people say, whoa, it's the wild Negro man, or whatever, and he's playing loud guitar, and that's really, that's too much for us to handle, because that's another reason that people don't understand. When you increase anything in volume, and that includes distortion, it scares everyone, and that's why you don't have a lot of positive black leaders. Like I told you before, one of my friends, she's trying to get into radio, and this is the reality. I stress this point because I don't think people understand it, what kind of position we're in versus a different cultural position a lot of people can't experience, because this is what's happening. And it's their own representation of their own cultures that are doing this to themselves. My friend, she's a very talented talk show DJ, and she wants to get on satellite radio and do terrestrial radio. But one of the roadblocks she has coming is she's really highly educated, and the fact that she is, now when I say this, I'm not exaggerating, the fact that she is educated and extremely articulate and a black woman, when you go for the urban market, it's segregation. I don't care what anyone says. It's segregation what's happened. Urban radio has basically singled out in most markets, and they'll basically say to your point blank to your face, well, I'm sorry, it goes, but you're a bit too educated for audience. And basically they don't say it with any, they don't frame it any other way. It's just, that's just the bottom line. Now, if it was a white DJ or someone of a different cultural but Caucasian tone.
Now wait a minute. I get what you're saying about that demographic segment or that format segment.
Yeah.
But David, there's such a thing as being too smart for white radio too.
Oh, well, I know, but what I'm saying is,
which is, you know, which is why you wind up with the Glenn Becks and the Rush Limbaughs and the Hannitys. The one thing that all these guys have in common, Glenn Beck, Hannity, Limbaugh, none of them ever finished a college degree. Do you realize that? I don't think, to expand it, Imus didn't, Stern didn't, Opie and Anthony didn't, Bob and Tom didn't. Now, some crackerjack outfit gave the Savage Wiener a degree because he sent in the Draw Spunky picture or something.
Yeah,
but he would not. Truthfully, he's degreed in something like nutrition, herbal nutrition, or something like that.
He told me something revealing. That guy with the guns who goes from like gun show, and he said, "I like Savage because he says I'm 92% right what I say on the radio, and the other 8% I can't say."
Yeah, there's a reason to be a fan. Hey, David, I got a roll here. I got them stacked up.
All right, later.
All right, talk to you later, David.
Hey.
Have a great weekend. Yeah, make no mistake, that's the big problem with terrestrial radio, is that it does not have room in it for intelligent people. It doesn't, no room at all. And that's why you wind up with Imus, and that's why you wind up with Limbaugh, and because it's about making the audience feel comfortable in its ignorance. Sorry, just is. That's why I love doing what I'm doing here. I get to deal with intelligent people, and it's not measured by whether you've got this degree or that degree. It's measured by whether or not you want your brain to keep working and keep expanding and keep growing and make connections from one idea to the next idea until they give birth to an entirely new idea. There aren't any new ideas on right-wing talk radio. Let's keep it rolling. Hey, who have I got?
Me?
Hey, Wayne, what's up, man?
Oh, same old, same old. Listen, I got to tell you, before we start talking about somebody else.
Yeah.
Let me think the right way to say this. Well, I don't like to comment about college educated. I'm not college educated.
Well,
a lot of people we deal with aren't.
Yeah, that's, well, that's what I just said. It's not.
But they know right from wrong.
Yeah, it's not about degrees hanging on walls. Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, it's not about degree.
It's not your level of education. It's knowing right from wrong. But anyway, I'm sorry to start out like that.
Well, no. That's why I said what I did. That's why I put the caveat on there that I did. But
oh, what job? Maybe I didn't hear because I was in between beeps.
Yeah.
What
well,
was that?
No, it's not about degrees hanging on walls. It's about being able to take an idea A and put it with idea B and being out there looking for idea C or fact D and processing those things and coming to the right conclusion. And it does, and you know, there's no college degree required for any of that.
Very good, Bob. I apologize. I didn't hear that part.
Okay. Well, I mean,
okay.
You know I'm no elitist snob.
No, I know you're not, you know, but it, you know, I've been confronted with that before. I guess that's why I'm sensitive, I guess.
Oh, yeah, too sensitive.
Yeah, sensitive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's up, buddy? I heard you talking about the, what is it, Employees Freedom Bill?
Yeah.
In West Virginia?
Yeah, I've made mention of that a couple of times and saw saw the damnedest news story today coming out of the Beckley paper. I mean, I just sort of, you know, spit my coffee through my nose.
Yeah,
talking about the lady who showed up at this hearing, and what we're talking about here is a bill that's trying to make its way through the legislature this session here in West Virginia that gives working people the right to not have to go to employee-sponsored, basically anti-union meetings.
Basically, yes.
Yeah, and so there was a hearing had on it, and some labor lawyer who works who's a company woman, so to speak, shows up and says that to tell people that they don't have to sit in these stupid meetings constitutes an infringement on the company's right of free speech. And, you know, there's just some stuff in my world that makes me, you know, one of these days we're going to get those rubber bricks made, because I tell you what, I need them, Wayne, because you just want to throw something when you read crap like that.
I was at the hearing, Bob.
Oh, you heard her say it for real and live and all of that?
In the gallery and, you know. Projectile vomiting came into mind, you know, but I couldn't quite. It's absolutely amazing what these people are arguing. Here's what this bill does. The bill gives the employee the right to say, I'd rather not go to that. I want to continue working. Because these are what they refer to as captive audience meetings. Your employer decides that they are going to have a meeting for 2 hours, which they're going to pay you for during your working hours, and you come and attend. And then they tell you, or they can tell you, their religious views, their political views, their anti-union views, their blah, 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 blah. All we're asking is that the employee have the right to say, I'd rather not attend that, I want to continue working, and not suffer any reprisal.
Like getting fired or hours cut.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, these arguments. And this lawyer arguing that the NLRB has those protections, for working people, the NLRB does no longer exist. All they do is rule against them. Who's our labor secretary?
That would be Elaine Chao.
And who's she married to?
That would be Mitch McConnell.
Oh, yeah, there's a real labor-friendly guy. And her, I mean, you know, bruh.
Yeah, nice. But well, and since, you know, since the woman, I don't know how she could say it with a straight face, knowing that the National Labor Relations Board hasn't taken up more than maybe hasn't rendered maybe more than two decisions in the last 8 years. Is, I mean, that's about statistically correct, isn't it? The one was.
I don't know. I might be. I mean, they've. I don't know. I guess they can't be called decisions. But they just. Clarified.
Oh, yeah, yeah, more clarifications. Yeah,
yeah, they clarified. Like, they clarified the time and a half rules.
Right.
Yeah, you know, so that, you know.
And they, well, and they clarified the Kentucky River nurses.
Yeah, they clarified that.
And they clarified people who flip burgers at McDonald's and made them industrial production artists.
If you show somebody else how to flip a burger, too, you're a supervisor.
Yep, no union for you.
That's it. You're a supervisor. So, you know, the fight, I mean, there are so many things to fight. It's, well, it's absolutely amazing. And, you know, we have, Democrats got a problem. You know, I mean, I think we have a problem in our elected officials. I don't know how to give these guys a spine. Now, you know, I'm an advocate of, you know, I know they're not perfect and all that, but I get, you know, does it come down to the lesser of two evils? I don't know. But, you know, got to vote for the Democratic nominee and see if maybe they get a greater majority. That'll help us give them a spine. And, you know, and that doesn't happen. That's not just on the national level. I mean, West Virginia is the same thing. We have working people have worked for years to install a Democratic government that is favorable to working people. And even these people are dragging their feet. You know, we try to, labor, organized labor, tries to get legislation passed and blah, blah, blah. And these people have the same problem as they have in D.C. You know, they don't, they haven't been emboldened, Bob. You know, that's
the, right. They're afraid they're afraid that, well, in this case, in this state, they're afraid that Vic Sprouse is going to call them names.
Yeah, or, yeah. Or the coal company.
Oh, well, yeah.
Don Blankenship.
And,
know,
and speaking of which.
He kicked his ass last year.
Yeah.
What the hell are you afraid of him for?
And yet, talk about emboldened. Now, there's some emboldened people. I just saw where, Don Blankenship's little handpicked, bought and paid for Supreme Court justice has refused to remove himself from yet another case involving, lo and behold, Don Blankenship and Massey Energy.
You mean the guy that paid $3.5 million to buy his seat on the Supreme Court?
Yeah, that guy.
That guy, yeah.
Yeah, and he's right. He won't.
They made a movie about it. And our legislators are sitting down there with their thumb up their ass, and I mean, why hasn't somebody started impeachment proceedings against this guy? I mean, my God, if there's ever been a more blatant...
You tell me. I mean, that seems like a slam dunk, and I'm no political Pollyanna, and I didn't just fall off the turnip truck. That one's easy. Impeaching Brent Benjamin in this state is easy. It's a no-brainer. Some Democrat somewhere in the state should have had that idea happen inside their skull, you know, just putting their scuffies on coming out of the bed in the morning.
Look what this guy has done. Okay, people have finally awakened and removed, raised enough hell so that, what's his name, Spike?
Yeah, Spike Maynard.
Finally recuses himself after, pictures on the Riviera or wherever the hell they were, I don't know.
The Principality of Monaco.
Supreme Court justice.
Yeah.
Is what the people have to understand. This guy, vacationed, a Supreme Court justice vacationed with a gentleman that is the CEO of a corporation that he was going to hear, what was it, $76.3 million case?
Right.
And ruled against.
Ruled against the plaintiff and protected the $76.3 million.
Exactly. And well, another guy on the court, Larry Starcher, who is definitely labor's friend, made critical comments about Don Blankenship, CEO of Massey Energy, and recused himself also. The newest member of the court, Brent Benjamin, that Don Blankenship, CEO of Massey Energy, spent $3.5 million of his own money to get elected, has decided that it's not a conflict of interest for him to hear this case.
Right, and he can be fair.
And he can be fair.
Well, I hate to, well,
God.
Keep an eye on the Charleston Gazette. You might see a letter to the editor in the paper about it.
Yeah, well, I mean.
And that letter just might happen to have language suggesting that if we had a responsible legislature, impeachment proceedings against Brent Benjamin would have already been instituted. I know for a fact,
exactly.
Because I know for a fact because the Gazette called me today to make sure that I was me and that and told me that
you were what?
That I was who I said I was and that they would in fact print the letter.
Oh well, I will look forward to that, my good man.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to see somebody read that and go, oh yeah. We've got good liberals and good Democrats in the West Virginia legislature. Has this not dawned on any of them, Wayne? I mean, there's good labor Democrats there that ought to understand that a guy who will rule with Don Blankenship would gleefully put the knife in the back of a labor organization. I mean, I'm not saying that you give anybody their marching orders or anything. No, but I mean, you talk to people.
I wish the hell I could give people some marching orders. We are, in many ways. See, we try to be too damn politically correct. Also, does that make any sense? I mean, we're a lot like the Democrats that we elected. We're not demanding. We're not, we want this legislation passed. And okay, well, fine. They water it down so much, you get something, but it's not worth anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's an issue of militancy. And everybody wants to think that everybody, we're all here, we all want the same thing. We want a better tomorrow for West Virginia. Can't we all just work together? And
well,
sometimes you can't.
And that's nationwide.
Yeah, and I understand that impulse, Wayne, but for heaven's sakes, do people not realize from time to time that there are just some folks you can't work with?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's been, talking about impeachment. Look at the president and the administration we have.
Yeah.
I mean, my God.
Started out the program this evening.
Committed impeachable defense or offenses.
Yeah, it would be him. I started out the program this evening talking about the fact that he's drawn a line in the sand on the telecom immunity. He has told the Democratic Congress that there will be no compromise on telecom immunity, that they will send him a bill with telecom immunity, and that he will veto anything else that comes up.
Well, then live under the law that exists now and get warrants.
Yeah, that, right. So what I'm suggesting is that the House not convene the conference committee to reconcile the House and Senate versions, because the Senate version has the telecom immunity in it. Just say, okay, well, we'll deal with that in the next Congress.
I know. Did you see on YouTube our good Senator Rockefeller arguing for that?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. That turns my stomach.
Well, I had rather strident and strong words for Rockefeller's office when that happened.
Jesus.
Because I explained to them that, while I have voted for him in the past, that this is a deal breaker for me. And that while I will not vote for his opponent, I do not have to vote for him. And,
well,
and that's
exactly. Well, you know, my line was the Military Commissions Act, but
yeah,
you know, he just further, you know, it's a deeper line now than it used to be.
And I'm not going to cross it. At some point in time, more. I remind myself that political choices are, in fact, or do, in fact, have moral implications. And to me,
certainly they do.
To me, the Bill of Rights is an embodiment not just of the rights, not just of human rights of American citizens, Wayne, but they are also an embodiment of how a government with a shred of ethics and morality should behave toward the people who empower it. And if you can't support that, you don't deserve my support.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, here's the thing that always gets me. And, you know, I've asked a lot of right-wingers this. What's the main function of government? I don't care what kind of government you have. I mean, you know, be it, you know, communist or whatever. And, you know, I mean, Russian constitutions and things like that, a lot of country constitutions prove it, that the main function of government is the welfare of the people that they govern. Is that not true?
Yeah, it is. It has to be, or else there's no country left worth having.
Well, buddy, these guys ain't looking out for our welfare. I mean...
Oh, there's welfare being looked out for. It just isn't ours.
There is. Not ours. Certainly not ours. And,
I mean, we're actually having to have a discussion in the state, Wayne, about whether a working man or woman has the right to get up and walk out of a meeting or just not attend the darn thing. We're actually having a discussion about that. That should be a no-brainer. That's one of those things that's kind of embodied in the Bill of Rights, both the West Virginia Constitution Bill of Rights and the United States Constitution Bill of Rights, and yet we're still having a discussion about it.
Exactly. And, you know, the labor lawyer that got up and says the National Labor Relations Act protects that, well, yeah, it does. But it is certainly not being enforced. You know, these people have turned that whole thing completely around. And I don't know if that was in the original act or if that was in, what was it, Louis LaGuardia or, you know, the thing that came a couple years after. When the original National Labor Relations Act was passed, the only people that had any rights were unions. After that, a couple years later, I think the act was passed in 35, and then Louis LaGuardia, I think that's the name, was passed in 37, and then that gave the company the same rights as unions. And, you know.
Yeah. Well, what is the future of this particular bill, Wayne? I mean, it's in committee. Is it going to make it out of committee?
It has.
Okay.
It made it out of Senate committee.
I know that, but what about the House? Has it even been introduced?
Yeah, it has. And, you know, John Overton and what's the guy? Your guy from Fayette County.
Not David
Pino.
Perry.
John Pino.
Yeah, John Pino, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God.
Congratulations on the self-restraint you just showed.
Yes, that's a whole nother show. Thank you very much for the compliment, Bob. But anyway, you know, I think we got a good shot of getting it passed. I will say one thing I follow all these things. Union membership in the country rose last year from 12% to 12.9%. Now, that does maybe not sound like a lot to a lot of people, but that reverses, I don't know.
A couple of decades of losses, yeah.
Years are going down.
Yeah. Well, that,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, the folks that I had on the program last night, Susan Arum and Paul Durenberger.
Oh, yeah, man, I listened a little bit. They're in Pennsylvania.
No, they're in State College.
Okay.
But, you know, the story they've told about the frankly heroic actions of those longshoremen, the Charleston Five in South Carolina, there is progress being made. And you know what? Nine tenths of 1% in terms of the entire American working population and union membership, that's a bunch of people.
That's significant.
And you know what? I would be happy if we could grow at 1% a year from here on out, because eventually you get to 100, and when America gets to 100% union membership, we will solve about 100% of the problems that this country faces.
Yep. Yep.
Kind of funny coming from a guy who doesn't belong to a union. I know, but you know.
You know what's what, man. All the people. What does a union do for people? It gives them a voice.
Yeah.
Well, no, what the hell's wrong with that? It gives us a voice. If we have enough members, it gives us a voice any stronger than any of these damn lobbyists. And who should have a stronger voice than the people?
Yeah, call me crazy, but I'm on the people's side with that one.
Me too, brother. Me too. So, you know, it's, I announced this at a meeting the other night about the labor, you know, gaining in, members of organized labor.
Yeah.
So after the meeting, one of the guys that always wants to bust my gonads anyway comes up to me and he said, "Well, how come you're so against George Bush? He increased labor, organized labor membership by 1 point." And I'll tell you what, Molesky, I'm going to give you this one. I'm going to thank George Bush for that. I says, because he has finally conducted administration that has finally awakened the working people, and they had enough of his baloney. And
thanks to George Bush, we may actually start organizing the Deep South, and man, that says something.
Yeah, exactly. And if that happens, hey, you were in the Deep South. You see, there's some segments who are already organized.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, remember, all them red states, it don't take but, you know, a few percent to change them.
Yeah, some of those are more purple than red.
A lot of them are more purple than red, I think. You know, well, I think working people are finally waking up. I said this a month or a couple months ago that, you know, I see an awakening of the people, and that can only be good when people take control of their own destiny and start paying attention to what these politicians on both sides of the aisle, I will add, are doing to us, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's great, man. I think it's absolutely great. So, now, who's going to be the nominee?
You got to think that Obama's got the inside track right now.
You certainly do.
Unless something drastic happens in Ohio and or Texas.
And that's always a possibility, too.
Senator Clinton is at the point where she has to win out.
Yes, she does. Yes, she does.
It's like these are the playoffs, lose and go home.
That's what it is. That's what it is. When's Texas? Tuesday?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that'll kind of tell the tale, I think.
I think it will, and after.
Well, if she loses that, then Obama has so much momentum, you know.
Yeah.
And, well, you know me, buddy. I will support and vote for the Democratic nominee. That's what I'll do.
Precisely. Well, Wayne, have yourself a great weekend, brother.
Is it that late, man?
Well, it is. I got a couple more stacked up, so.
Oh, well, hey, go for it. I'll talk to you later, man.
All right. I'll catch you, man. See ya.
All right, brother. Bye.
Bye. Love hearing from Wayne. Down there fighting the fight in Charleston. I love hearing from people who actually put their actions where their hearts lie. Feet on the street, man. You can't beat it for winning fights. Let's keep it rolling. Hi, who have I got?
Hey, this is Kate.
Hey, Kate.
KRZ. This is Kate at WKRZ, and the phone's ringing in the studio, and I don't answer. So, sorry for the background noise.
That's okay.
I'm glad that I didn't get in till late because I was fired up earlier because I had a thought sometime listening to earlier conversations from people around and on the talk radios and just the general tenor of the country, I guess. And then you mentioned the $4 bread and the one loaf of rye bread, and I thought, yeah, bingo, it's just making it too easy. And then Peter's calling in with it sounding so pitiful. When it all, I'm back to this, what does it matter stuff, you know, I'm not beating it to death, but I just, I'm tired of the conversations that dominate people, the subjects that dominate people's minds or whatever. Because, like, when you and Agnes were so sick with babies and Peter's so sick, did you guys give any thought to what was going on, like the circus that was going on mainstream media?
You want the truth?
Oh, you did. Okay, you were concerned.
I'm never far from it. I desperately need 30 days on a little island somewhere that's warm and toasty with a hollowed out coconut shell with a profoundly strong beverage in it and an umbrella in the top. Okay, I do. But even then, I would go shambling barefoot to the local internet cafe, and yeah, you know what I'd go looking for.
I know. I do the same thing, and that's But I just thought, you know, I wonder when. Like, when it all hits the fan and it kind of coming to an end for me, I'm wondering, am I gonna think, oh, God, I wish I hadn't spent so much time fussing and arguing about Democrats and Republicans?
I understand that, but the question is how it comes to the end. And the other question is how good or bad is it before the end comes, Kate? And when we fuss and we fume about candidates, that's really... oh, God, there's a psychological term for this. It's some level of transference, I think, whereby the issues we're concerned about are sort of shorthandedly stood in for. Wow, I'm just taking the language out and beating it to death behind the barn with this attempt. But we use...
Okay, nobody's listening.
I love you, too.
Peter and I say that. Go ahead and say it. Nobody's listening.
Yeah. Okay. but no. Really. That's how we define the issues. Because it does matter. And you know, no matter how many people can make, no matter how many people make the Nader argument, I'm not buying into it that there's not that much difference between Hillary and McCain or Obama and McCain, because at the end of the day, there is a boatload of difference, and the difference is profound. So as a consequence of that, you know me, Kate, I don't give a rat's rear end about whether somebody used a phrase in a speech that was used by somebody else. Maybe that's because of the nature of what I do. I steal lines constantly, and so does anybody who's in the talking business. Winston Churchill did not come up with all of his great lines by himself. He heard them along the way. It's the nature of being in that sort of an enterprise or an endeavor.
There's no original thought.
No. No, everything is a function of some sort of an archetype. So, when Senator Clinton wants to, because she's desperate for an issue or something, wants to and is taking the advice of somebody that's cost her $10 million, and can't seem to get too many primaries won, and she wants to use that line, fine, let her, you know, but I'm just at a place in my head and in my heart, Kate, where that doesn't matter to me. I want to hear, you know, I was glad to hear a discussion of some sort about Cuba. I was glad to hear a discussion of some sort about health care. Because, you know, no, I'm not going to Cuba anytime soon, but the things that the big people decide about Cuba have a hell of an impact on little bitty people who live there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't want to empower these former fascists who had to flee Cuba to go down and start killing poor brown people because they want their damn sugarcane fields back.
Yeah, and see, this is just none of our business, and we're button in, we're all over, and it just annoys me to no end how we just can't mind our own business, and we're not focusing on things. Nobody's paying any attention to the $4 bread, okay? I mean, somebody is. It must be. There's no original thought. I'm not the only one.
It ain't for want of me talking about it.
Well, I mean, if in fact there is no original thought, there must be somebody out there who's thought this before me. I apologize for the phone. I can't answer the studio phone.
Don't worry about it.
I don't think I have that sensitive a mic anyway. but for instance, when I was laying in bed last night waiting on the tornado watch to come and, listening to the trucking network, and the guy said, well, we just drove through Wells and my wife was driving and dumped a trucker, and he said then we drove by and they blocked off the exits to the town and stuff. And so when I got up this morning, I went right to and found out, and this is 6.0 in Wells, Nevada, and the old historical downtown was destroyed, and Flying J truck stop was closed, and the high school gym, or the high school, had to be closed because, there were chemicals that spilled in the science lab, and, you know, the town was a mess. And there was a 6.2, I think, in Norway, which it never, ever happened, never. And a bunch of, there was a 5.0 and a 4.0 in Israel, Lebanon, Syria area. And so all of this just points out to me that there's something, you know, like Mother Earth is telling us something. And we're on the verge of something. And the $4 bread is part of it, and the earth changes. Volcanoes are evacuating thousands of people around Mexico City at times, and people are dying in the snow in China, and then they got the rice problem, and then we got the wheat problem here, and people were arguing about the aquifers today about being a water shortage, and they said, well, we live down here, we don't have any shortage of water. And I said, do you remember what it was like when Katrina blew in and you didn't have any water? There is not going to be any water. There is no, the water tables are going down and down and down. And so I just have this, thank you for Preston calling in saying he didn't want to be negative but wanted to say some things. And I just, and then the Turks invade Iraq and kill the Kurds for us. I mean, what's up with that?
Let's all stand and sing.
Huh?
Let's all stand and sing.
Praise God.
Thank God the Turks are out there protecting. Because, I mean, you know, we've been told a million times that the United States, that the U.S. military is in Iraq because they're fighting for our freedom. Well, I guess that means the Turks are fighting for our freedom, too. So, you know.
Yeah, they're just going in killing Kurds so we don't get blamed for it. And we're probably giving them the ammunition.
No, they're killing Kurds for our freedom.
Oh, that's right. So we don't lose another office building in some big city. Okay.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just had this thought. I'm doing a lot of little detail work and some administrative stuff in the station. We had a lot of rain today, and so I'm just kind of parked here in the FEMA cramper doing work. And I just had this thought.
The cramper?
Like, what if it? Yeah. Well, yeah. It's a little bitty one.
Love that word. That's just precious.
Little radio station up in the front end of it, and the Bryce's room and everything else is in the back end, and I sit here in the middle and do work and whatever. Anyway, I just think, like, when the end of the world as we know it comes, I mean, and there's no food and there's no gas and there's no electric and there's no spray.
Yeah. Kate. Uh-oh. I think we lost Kate. That happens in places like the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Oh, is that Kate again? Well, let's see. Here we go. Let's try this one. Hi, who have I got?
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
I hear you well. Do you hear me?
Yeah. Maybe Kate will call back. Michelle.
Oh, I know. Hey, Michelle, how are you?
You know that voice, do you? That's what my
friend. You'd be surprised. I'm quite good at recognizing most of the voices.
Well, you know, I think that's one of your talents. I hope Kate calls back. And if the phone rings, go ahead and answer it, you know. But
no, I think she'd want me to go on and talk to you.
Yeah, I was in the chat room. I went in the chat room and said, hey, I'm on hold with this radio station in West Virginia, and this lady Kate's on. Then she goes, well, I'll hurry, Michelle. She types in there while she's talking to you. That girl is talented.
Whole bunch of multitaskers.
Oh, man. They're talented. That's what I have.
Oh, that reminds me. You mentioned the chat room. Do you know that we had a free floating right winger come into the chat room last night? It was after the show, and God knows they've never got the guts to call the program or anything. But
no.
we had a real live, honest to God, George W. Bush has never broken the law right winger in the chat room last night.
Wow.
Yeah, and the thing is, those people have gotten so rare and they're so thoroughly hidden now, Michelle, that it's like seeing a dinosaur walk down Main Street.
Yeah,
because we were all just sitting. In the chat room, you know, because we were all just like, "Wow, you really, you're not pulling our leg. You really believe that crap?"
I'm sorry, I missed it.
And yeah, all this critter was for real.
Oh, you know, one of my
Lottie tore him apart with mathematics, and Seppo. I think Seppo just vibrated into pieces.
Oh my God! Oh God, I missed it. I really did. You know, I used to love going into Yahoo political chat for that very reason. I mean, we'd have a room and people would come in there and just debate us. And, you know, it was just like, this is too, at points it was too fun. You know? And then at points it was just kind of gross. But, you know, to believe the rhetoric, or for people to believe such rhetoric. But, you know, I had asked ELO what I couldn't remember. I didn't hear the guy, the previous caller to Kate. I didn't hear his name, and she said it was Wayne.
Yeah, well, yeah, that was Wayne. That was her buddy.
And I had called him because I wanted to talk to you about what I'd heard from a friend of mine that had been to Turkey recently, and the exchange rate, you know, that they'd rather have. In fact, they prefer the euro. They don't want any dollars and all of that. And just talking about, you know, how devastating it is, and, you know, to see the dollar like looking like the peso.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of goes along the lines of, remember the day after tomorrow, I think it was?
Yeah. Where
you have the new broadcaster. People are crossing the border into Mexico illegally, you know, trying to escape the freeze, right? So which is a major dichotomy, you know. We're always bitching about people crossing the border, you know what I'm saying. Kind of explaining it for no reason, aren't I, Bob?
Oh, I get it.
Anyway, but then Wayne called and had kind of a grievance, not really a grievance, but, you know, mentioned something about higher education.
Yeah, well, Wayne keeps me honest because he was afraid I was getting elitist.
Well, and I'm going to be the devil's advocate here, I guess you're going to, and maybe you guys won't like me after this.
Oh, no, stop that. Just say it.
I totally believe that education is the major problem in our society. I believe that every U.S. citizen should have the education. In fact, charging our students, college, whatever, the fact that we charge them to be educated, to produce for us, is absolutely insidious. You know, we're damning ourselves. And to say that education is elitist is working into, it's playing their game. It's not elitist to be educated. It's smart. It's survival of the fittest.
Right. And the problem lies in the fact that we don't have enough of it.
Right. Exactly. And simple knowledge doesn't get it. Simple knowledge didn't get us on the moon. We need to understand the history, factual history. We need to understand the factual history of unions. How did they come about? Because people were ignorant.
Because as a remedy there too, I understand what you're saying. We need to teach our labor history. We don't. We need to teach our social and our cultural history. We don't. We have a disregard for history in general. This current administration, Michelle, stated plain and simple that it had no interest in learning from the past, that they make their own reality. That was their word, not mine. We make our own reality.
That's right.
You know, the last person I saw who was making his own reality was a dude who just dropped acid.
Well, and just like you were talking about earlier with Bill Bimbo O'Reilly.
Yeah.
To be able to state that, and for the masses not to be calling and writing and saying, what the majigas?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, what's going on here? It is a lack of... What do you think they've done to the education? Every year I see them, you know, we'll get a few steps forward and some...
Destroying... Please understand, Michelle, that destroying the public education system is and always has been a linchpin of Republican policy. Because the Republican Party, and you can prove it, you know, just listen to talk radio. Listen to right-wing talk radio if you can do it without having your brainstem come unhooked. And you'll hear the effect of the Republican assault on education. They need the Republican Party and its corporate masters and its religion industry masters need a stupid populace, because it is only an undereducated, uneducated, ill-educated, ignorant population that will ever, ever, ever submit itself to Republican rule.
Well, and it's cyclical. To stay in the educational, it's cyclical in the sense of it takes the extreme for things to get to change, for the people to move against and change, to dissent. It takes, and that is totally a sign of ignorance, a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding. From A, you get B. You know, you do this. I mean, to hear someone tell me that corporations, you know, businesses, they just hardly can survive because of the taxes. I'm like, do you just realize, do you understand that, just like I talked about before with you, you know, Citizens for Tax Justice, have you read, I mean, do you understand the percentile? That's where, and then I want to take it, I don't know if I can, but I want to take it to the level of, that's where you have people that want to shut you down because they justify it and say, you're an elitist. Because they can't accept that there's something, I know I need to listen to you, I need to listen to Kate, I need to listen to Wayne, I need to listen to other people that are involved, but then I know I need to go and I need to read, and I need to research, and I need to talk to others to find out. I can't just believe what I hear on the radio, I can't just believe you,
I can't.
And if you ever catch me telling anyone that, you know, believe me because I said it.
No.
Let me know, because
your arrogance is not within that. You know where your arrogance is?
I'm arrogant?
Yeah, you know where it is?
Where?
It is your compassion for life and those that live around you. That you have such strength in knowing that you have to have compassion. And, yeah, I mean, I guess that's arrogant. I guess that's a knowing that this is the way it should be. Maybe it's a security, but to me, no, I've never heard you, you know, be so arrogant to say.
I mean, if I'm wrong, I want to be told I'm wrong, because.
Well, thank you. Please don't let me continue being the idiot. Idiot, lack of knowledge. So I have a problem when they say it's an elitist. And damn it, college out here in California, right? Remember, it used to be free.
That's
they
true.
Used to have college education. 2 years, you didn't pay. For the 2 year college, you didn't pay crap. For the 4 year state college, you paid a minimum, maybe $500, you know?
Yeah.
And boy.
Yeah, gone are the days.
No kidding. Our kids can't survive. That's where it comes back to the young man, that friend of the family who went to Turkey, business sent him to Turkey, and talking about, you know, I make a good wage, he says, but I still live at home. I'm in debt because of school. Sorry. And, you know, I'm looking at my stepson who's going to law school. He's going to be in debt over $130,000, if not more.
And you know what? Because of that debt, let's talk about that for a minute, Michelle.
Okay.
And this is in no wise a criticism of your stepson, okay? Are we clear on that, first of all? Because of the debt that he is going to have, he is going to have to take the highest paying job that he can find.
Right.
Now, most anybody wants the highest paying job they can find. That's human nature. However, where the law is concerned, that means that he is probably going to have to take a job with.
He doesn't defend the people?
With a big law firm doing either defense of insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
Or defense of corporations or corporate representation. He will be required to put in something probably approaching 7,000 billable hours per year, which means that he will go to work on Monday morning at 6 or 7 a.m. He will work till 6 or 7 p.m. all the way, and he'll get a break on Saturday because he won't have to be in till noon.
Yeah.
If he's lucky, he'll get Sunday off, but since he's carrying the briefcase for a senior partner, there will probably be work on Sunday, too. And that will be the next 10 to 15 years of his life.
Exactly.
And he will be making a tidy salary. The vast majority of that salary will be going to debt service.
It's a sad perpetuation. And it goes back to what you were talking about earlier, you know, with one of the other callers about corporations and, no, your guest. You all were talking about corporations and their rights, you know, as individuals. They have individual rights.
Yeah.
It's absolute bull crud.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, but that it's an overarching problem in education.
Yeah.
Because that's what happens. You know, we're not just talking about law students. We're talking about medical students. We're talking about somebody going and getting. And in fact, I know Horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner has addressed this from time to time. The people who wind up doing most of the in the trenches, in the middle of the tragedy, psychology grunt work, aren't psychologists.
Right.
They are, in fact, social workers.
Yep.
With social work degrees. All right? So what happens is those people, in order to get that level of work, get a master's in social work, and they still maybe make $18,000 a year. And they're sometimes little better off than the people they're trying to serve. So what, and that's just an example. But what happens coming out of college, to talk about the value or whatever of a college education, what happens is you get really, really good, dedicated, motivated students coming out of colleges, especially the small liberal arts colleges that have just spent 4 years teaching these young, brilliant minds who had to really be smart and bust their ass to get in the first place. They come out so loaded with debt that they have to take the first job with some crappy corporation.
Right.
Doing a crappy job that they never wanted to do, and they have to put their dreams on hold or just get rid of their dreams altogether. Never mind changing the world. You gotta keep the lights on. And you gotta keep the student loan secret police off your ass.
It's a system made to fail.
No, it's a system. It is a system. It's a system that is designed to keep people from doing life-changing work, Michelle.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the reason when I say it's a system made to fail the society.
Yeah, and to fail the student. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a dream slaughterer.
Exactly. And that's why I come back to it is mandated of our society. We should mandate that we understand how important education is, because then we get people to think, well, we should pay taxes.
Hey, look at it this way. If you take the really smart people and you let them pursue their dreams and their ideas, and you fund education maybe at the expense of a little bit of the defense budget, it might not be necessary to prepare for war anymore somewhere down the road, because you'll have enough smart people to keep us out of them.
Thank you.
But we don't want that. Yeah. Oh, hell no, we don't want that.
Not capitalism. We got to pull ourselves.
Yeah, that's not the free market. If we're not subsidizing the defense industry, we ain't got no free market. Jesus, I know. Hey, Michelle, I got to roll along. Have a great weekend.
I love you guys.
All right. Hey to hubby.
Okay.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Michelle, the gal from Cal, our buddy in Orange County. Orange County's lone liberal. Love her to death. And if you're on hold, 1, 2, 3, 4, all four of you, I'm sorry. We'll get it Monday, maybe. Because it's time to go. Coming up, a rerun of Strictly Confidential with the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio host, Peter Godbold, followed by a live, real live, honest-to-goodness horn section with me and with horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner. Rick will be subbing as well at midnight Eastern time for John Fox and All Foxed Up. Okay? So stick around. No reason to go anywhere. Is there ever? Thanks to Peter Godbold. Thanks to John Fox. Thanks to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Most especially, thanks to all the hardworking folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. Join up. Not even very expensive. And thank you to those of you who continue to make the horn a reality. I can talk all night long, but without you and your financial support, the talking doesn't go anywhere, and the dialogue and the discussion just doesn't happen. We're still a long way off from even hitting our basic $2,000 a month goal for February. We would sincerely appreciate, we always do, your help. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Aha, we fooled you. You thought that strange QNN lady was going to come up and do the news. Oh, no, no, no. Rumor has it she was terribly injured in an accident while fighting the war on Christmas. By the way, there are only 10 days left in the war on Christmas. Remember, kill a tree before it kills you. And so let's actually begin the show now with good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to book, chapter, and verse 87 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBTQQS version of Conversation Radio. That's lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, queer, queer questioning, and straight. Exclusively on listener-supported Head On Radio Network. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is indeed Friday, December the 14th. So if you are listening on a Friday evening shortly after 9 p.m., which is December the 14th, you're indeed listening to a live show, and you're welcome to phone in and talk to myself and to the guest, which I will be introducing her at the bottom of the hour. Our guest will be joining us at the bottom of the hour this evening. It's Nadine Smith, by the way, from Equality, Florida. We are going to be talking about the fact that the fundies have finally gotten enough signature petitions to put the gay marriage issue on the ballot in the 2008 elections, which of course is never good. They want an amendment. To ban it completely. You know the drill. We'll get all into that with Nadine when we talk to her. That will be at the bottom of the hour. I'll give out the toll-free line numbers then. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests as well as to the audio archives from past shows. You'll find links to the guests' websites also. You'll find links to the chat room, which is active as we speak. We have Cobwebs and ELO, and we have Frozy and Jersey and myself, Lauder J, Nanette, Poppy, Ralphs, and Randy D in the room this evening. And if you're not logged into the Head On Radio Network chat room, you are indeed missing quite a party. We're rolling the disco balls right now. It's so nice to be welcome to the Strictly Confidential show in the chat room with the myriad of rotating glass disco balls. That makes my day. Let's see, where was I? You'll find links on strictlyconfidentialradio.com also for Head On Radio Network, where you can actually support the network by using the PayPal buttons that you'll find located at headonradionetwork.com. And there's a link to that on strictlyconfidentialradio.com. The PayPal buttons are on the right-hand side of the screen, so if they're the right-hand side of your screen, you may have to scroll to the right to see it. I'm not sure what the resolution was. Apparently that was an issue earlier today. And you can find out about all of the other progressive programming